Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Bernadine Sung Magazine with Compass Real Estate, serving buyers and sellers throughout Greater Boston. Learn more at homesbybernadine.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, represented by Anna Pressley, is calling for the impeachment and removal of Donald Trump for the role he played in inciting the insurrection on Capitol Hill on Wednesday. In the violence and chaos that ensued as the pro-Trump mob stormed through the federal building, five people have died. Pressley will join us to discuss urgent calls to reconvene Congress and impeach the president again, and we'll take your calls.
A new documentary captures the death of a democracy, not by one abrupt moment, but by a thousand cuts that weaken it to its breaking point. A Thousand Cuts by documentarian Ramona Diaz refers to the Philippines under Rodrigo Duterte and tracks one journalist as she navigates an escalating war and crackdown on the press. Filmmaker Ramona Diaz will join us to discuss ahead on Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH. GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Did you hear the NPR news at the top of the hour?
Yes, I did.
So do you want to join me in filing an amicus brief in the Dominion's $1.3 billion libel suit against Sidney Powell? I'll draw it up tonight. So think about it and you can file it on Monday.
Yeah, they're suing lots of people. They're suing the Newsmax, too. I hope they prevail.
So to fully comprehend the degree to which Trump is threatening democracy and the safety of American citizens, with only 12 days left of his presidency, there are urgent calls to remove him from office before he can do more harm. Among the first to make that call was Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. Yesterday, she unveiled a resolution to impeach Trump for high crimes and misdemeanors. She joins us on the line to talk about this, how law enforcement's response to this week's insurrection was literally the difference between black and white, and more. She represents the 7th Congressional District. Congresswoman, we really appreciate your calling in. Thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Congresswoman. Well, as Jim just said, you were among the first to recommend that the president be taken out of office with 12 days left, the 25th Amendment. But there are only 12 days left, Congresswoman. How realistic is any kind of removal at this point?
I think it's realistic. When we, myself and Representative Omar, when we introduced these articles, since then we have over 100 co-sponsors, and I know there's growing bipartisan support. You know, the acts of domestic terrorism that occurred at the Capitol, they really make clear what we've known for years, that Donald J. Trump, he is a grave threat to our democracy, and he must immediately be removed from office. He actively incited a violent, white supremacist insurrection. He endangered the lives of members of Congress, staff, workers in the Capitol, and once again demonstrated his contempt for democratic rule of law and the will of the American people. You know, it's just the fact that just 4 days ago that my colleagues and I were sworn in and took an oath of office, you know, to support and to defend our Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. That includes the president of the United States himself in this unfortunate moment. So, yes, it's 12 days, but he is unfit to serve and he is dangerous. And we cannot afford one more day with Trump in office. He has to immediately be impeached by the House of Representatives and removed from office by the United States Senate. And that's why early on, I co-led the introduction of articles of impeachment. And I'm calling on Democratic leadership. Now they've responded that we will be. I know we're convening a Democratic caucus today by phone, and that articles of impeachment are expected to be on the floor sometime next week.
But if I may, Congresswoman, following up on what Marjorie asked, then I don't disagree with any of your factual analysis of what's happened the last few days. 147 of your Republican colleagues in the House, even after this attempted coup, still voted against the certification of votes for Joe Biden. Six senators, I think, maybe seven, still did it. Even if Trump is impeached a second time in the House, which I assume he will be next week, is there any reason to think there are 17 Republicans or even, well, I don't know about Mitt Romney, even two Republicans who would vote to remove him from office before January 20th?
Again, momentum continues to grow on that front. But to the point that you're making there, Jim, I would just underscore that, you know, Donald Trump is not alone in his culpability for what took place in Washington, nor for the hatred and the violence that he has sown in our communities. You know, I would say his entire adult life, but certainly these past several years. And, you know, Republicans, they share in the responsibility for these consequences, for fomenting hate and turning a blind eye to his violence, his extremism. And that's why I have joined in partnership with freshman member Representative Cori Bush. I've signed on to her resolution calling for investigations and the immediate expulsion of those members who have, you know, been complicit and carried the water for Trump's cruelty, his corruption, for his dangerous rhetoric and policies, too. And they incited these blatant attempts to overturn our elections and to disenfranchise millions of voters. And the irony here is that, you know, my colleagues across the aisle often characterize themselves as patriots.
Yeah. Congresswoman, where were you on when this whole happened? This whole thing went down on this week?
Yeah, so I was in my office, but let me first just sort of start at the top of the day. You know, I headed into the Capitol with a close friend and colleague of mine, and we were speaking excitedly and hopefully about the future of our country, because this was hours after the victories of Reverend Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, respectively. And, you know, came in just feeling so hopeful that day. And thanks to the leadership and the preparedness of my chief of staff, Sarah Groh, who had taken all of the precautions to ensure that we would have a safe route of entry into the building, because we were anticipating what we thought would be protesters, you know, not domestic terrorists.
Yeah.
But that being said, knew that there was potential for it to go very bad, very left. And so I think, you know, we felt that once we were in the building, that we were going to be safe. We could never have anticipated what occurred. And so there was a moment there where we were in the dark, on the ground with gas masks in our hands, with furniture and water bottles used to barricade the doors closed. And it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying.
You know, you, Congresswoman, we're talking to Ayanna Pressley, obviously. You've called for an investigation of what happened that day, and I assume part of that is the performance of law enforcement. And I know it appears people haven't reached conclusions yet, but the mildest criticism is that the appropriate authorities were totally unprepared, despite the fact that a lot of people knew there were going to be a lot of people, even if they didn't think it was going to lead to this. And the most serious charges is that some of the officers involved were collaborators with the rioters. Where do you fall on this, based on what you know, just based on the last couple of days?
Again, this was a violent insurrection by white supremacist terrorists who appear to have been aided and abetted by law enforcement. We already know they were enabled by Trump and Republicans in Congress who sought to undermine our democracy. And in my capacity on the House Oversight Committee, that's why I'm, you know, pursuing a thorough and transparent investigation into what happened yesterday and how our law enforcement agencies failed to protect the Capitol and members of Congress from an armed right-wing mob. The American people, they do deserve to know who these assailants were. And there's been loss of life. And furthermore, there's really no need, Jim, to speculate on how different the response from law enforcement would have been if it were a group of mostly black and brown or disabled folks. We have enough evidence to know exactly what the difference would have been. So this was a coordinated terrorist attack that enabled these terrorists to storm the Capitol, to break windows, and to ravage the halls of Congress and to terrify its members. And, you know, Jim and Roger, I feel that I'm off this. Since I've been in Congress, there have been so many unprecedented things to occur. And I remember us speaking with one another after the murder of George Floyd. And, you know, really just trying to keep it together here. It was a terrifying moment. And it was to see a noose hung on the West Lawn of the Capitol, to see people parading through the halls of Congress with Confederate flags. It was frighteningly familiar. And I cannot pretend that there were not legitimately moments where I feared for my life.
We're talking to Ayanna Pressley. Congresswoman, what does it say to you that I haven't seen a poll since Wednesday, but I'm assuming things are as they've been for 4 years, that 70% of Republicans in this country think the election was stolen? As I said before, the vast majority of your Republican colleagues in the House appear to support the Trumpian agenda, including overturning the election. What does that say about the state of democracy in January of 2021?
You know, I'm certainly not in denial about those dynamics. They are sobering. They are sad. They're dangerous. But, you know, I'm really just trying to reclaim some of my joy about what happened in Georgia. And about the fact that we have elected Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and that I hope that we are turning the page on this dark chapter in our history. But in the here and now, what I remain firmly focused on, again, is the removal of Trump from office, and also those members of Congress who have been accomplices in this insurrection. In this undermining of free and fair elections and of a smooth transfer of power, which has been, you know, this has been a pillar in our democratic institutions. And that was all eroded. But I might also add here that the flames that have been emboldened by Donald Trump and his minions with his racist and dangerous rhetoric and policies, that even once we get rid of him, we still have our work to do. Mm-hmm. You know, these are issues that have really got to be addressed at the root. And again, the pandemic has certainly laid bare against this national reckoning on racial injustice. These persistent and nagging inequities and disparities in racial injustices. And so I don't think that our response should just be business as usual. And that's why within hours of the Capitol being seized upon, my staff and I were working in partnership with Representative Omar to draft these articles of impeachment, and why I supported Representative Bush's resolution for the immediate expulsion of those Republican members.
By the way, I should just say, if I may, you mentioned the transition of power, and Trump did this little hostage video last night talking about the transition and focusing. We should say right before we went on the air, Trump tweeted that he will not be attending the inauguration on January 20th, even though apparently Vice President Pence will be. We're talking to Ayanna Pressley, Congresswoman.
You know, Congresswoman, I just learned this morning that online the intent of these rioters was well known. They were talking about getting guns and other weapons, and whether you could smash the windows of the Capitol, or whether the windows were reinforced, and you know, how to get into the building, what streets to get on. I mean, this was all online, which makes it even more incredible. I know that the head of the Capitol Police has resigned, the sergeant of arms has resigned, But how concerned are you going forward? Since I would assume people that pay attention knew this before this attack on the Capitol, how concerned are you about the inauguration?
Well, the chief of Capitol Police, he needed to resign, but he still needs to be held accountable again, which is why, in my capacity with the House Oversight Committee, I am demanding a full and thorough investigation so that we can better understand what individuals and what agencies enabled these violent white supremacists to seize our Capitol and to terrify our members. Of course, I have concerns and I have a lot of questions. And when we next come together in caucus, I'll begin to ask those questions. But this has shaken the foundation of our sense of, you know, trust and safety and security, certainly.
Ayanna Pressley, can we talk about a topic? I was going to say back home, but it's sort of back home and back in D.C. Marty Walsh is about to become Labor Secretary, should he be confirmed by the Senate. And Kim Janey is about to become the first woman and the first person of color to be mayor of Boston. Could you give us some reaction to both?
Marty Walsh, not bad for a kid from Dorchester. which is, you know, an incredible community, you know, humble origins there. And I want to congratulate the mayor on his nomination. And I do also want to just, again, as I'm trying to reclaim my joy that was stolen from us hours after the Ossoff and Warnock victories, just acknowledge the history that is being made, you know, by my sister in service, Kim Janey. She will become the first Black person, the first woman mayor to serve as the mayor of our city. I've never been so excited to send a text message to someone. And so to begin the morning saying good morning, Madam Mayor, felt pretty damn good. And representation matters. And Kim is going to be a fierce advocate for the people of Boston. She has been a champion for equity. She's been a truth teller, a justice seeker. She is, speaking of neighborhood pride, as I was referencing Dorchester with Marty Walsh, she is a daughter of Roxbury, and boy, does she represent that legacy well.
You know, back to Marty Walsh, though, for a second. Was he the right choice in your estimation? You've been pretty outspoken about the importance of diversity in this cabinet, and if reports are to be believed, the other serious candidate was Labor Secretary Sue from California, who was the preferred candidate of Asian American groups and legislators, Pacific Island legislators and advocates. Did Joe Biden make the right choice, Congresswoman?
Well, I've been in close communication with the Biden-Harris transition on everything from cabinet appointments to sub-cabinet appointments to policy priorities and, again, just pushing according to what they campaigned on, that they wanted to have a cabinet that would be representative of the American people. You know, look, I've always believed the people closest to the pain should be closest to the power. You know, Marty is making history in that he's the first union member to hold this position. I am encouraged by a number of the appointments, but I'm not yet satisfied. And so all I can do is just to continue to make that push. I think people, you know, think that a push for diversity and representation is about, you know, pictures that better reflect what our country looks like. You know, that's not the benefit. And that certainly is not why I champion. The benefit of representation, the power of that diversity of perspective, opinion, and thought has everything to do with lived experience and has everything to do with then how that lived experience shows up in the policies that they enact. And so I'm going to continue to push both on cabinet, sub-cabinet. There are some, you know, 4,000 positions that remain to be filled, and I'm working very hard to make sure that we have representation from this region, specifically from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We have a deep bench of talent here, and I want that us to have the benefit, you know, of that genius. So I'm just going to keep pushing.
You know, Anna Presley, let's get back to Season the Joy for a minute. You know, I'm old enough to remember, and everybody in political power in Boston was like me. They were an Irish Catholic. You know, it was O'Malley, O'Sullivan, O'Neill. It was Flaherty, everything. Then it was a big deal when Tom Menino became the mayor. Because, oh, my God, the Italians are now on the move. You know, he got Menino in the mayor's office, and Joe Malone was treasurer, whatever he was. This is like an African-American woman, you know, tsunami here. We've got you in Congress. We've got Kim Janey's going to be the first black woman mayor of Boston. We've got Rachel Rollins, who is a fearless district attorney with a lot of power. You've got Andrea Cabral on the city council. Andrea Campbell on the city council. You've got Andrea Cabral, who's no longer, the sheriff of Suffolk County in public safety, but she's on our show all the time. She's a real powerhouse. And you got Michelle Wu, Asian American, not a woman, a black woman, but it's like this incredible thing that's happening here, I think.
It's pretty incredible. And, yeah. You know, it's about time. Boston, Massachusetts has had a reputation for a long time as being a progressive place, you know, given the fact that we have been pace setters when it comes to marriage equality and health care reform, to name a few. But we have certainly not been pace setters when it comes to leadership parity, when it comes to gender and race. And so to see the strides that have been made, it wasn't that long ago, my husband and I were looking at my swearing in for my first city council. And when you see those images today, it has completely changed.
Yeah.
Maureen Feeney retired shortly after I was elected. And so I think for maybe two terms, don't quote me, but maybe for two terms, I was the only woman on that body. Mm-hmm. And when you look at that body today, and you see how diverse it is, racially, culturally, gender, intergenerational. It's exactly what our government should look like. It should be representative of the citizenry that it serves. And in doing that, again, people are bringing their lived experiences and their expertise to the table, and it certainly shapes the policies they champion and who they extend a hand to and make sure is at the table with them. We've made great strides. They were long overdue. And I'm excited about the direction that we're moving.
And while I'm on this little joyous celebration here, you could certainly argue that Stacey Abrams is the reason that the Democrats are going to have their representation in the House. I mean, she's been working for 10 years. Sorry, Senator, I'm goofing everything up here. I apologize. In the Senate. And she and a bunch of African-American women working for years in Georgia. I mean, Stacey Abrams kind of did it.
Well, and I want to thank, there are many, black women that I'll acknowledge, everyone from Tracy Lewis, who is an African-American political operative who has spent a lot of time, cutting her teeth and here in Massachusetts and was running the coordinated campaign out there. Nakima Williams, who's now my classmate in the 117th Congress. She is the chair of the Georgia State Party, and she was appointed to finish out John Lewis's. She was appointed to John Lewis's seat. Stacey Abrams, I mean, that has been my friend for over a decade, and I love her story about when she lost the governorship, which I think was stolen from her because of voter suppression and unjust purging. But that she took 10 days to sit Shiva. And after that, she started planning. Right. And so we're grateful for Stacey Abrams and Fair Fight, but also the Asian American Advocacy Fund, the Mahenty PAC, a Song Power PAC, and many more. As I've said, over and over again, if history is written by the winners, the reason why we're able to turn the page in this dark chapter in our history, the reason why Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were decisively, historically elected, is because the most marginalized came together. And there are people who have been on the ground organizing, doing community-based engagement and mobilization work for decades, who have gone unrecognized and uncelebrated, like LaTosha Brown from Black Voters Matter.
So great.
They just have had their head down. And one of those women said in an interview yesterday, She said, I'm not used to being thanked. I almost don't know how to respond because we have just been head down, focused on organizing and mobilizing. And I'll wrap this by saying I love Reverend Barber's approach, which is that there's no such thing as red states and blue states. There are only unorganized states. And so when Latasha Brown from Black Voters Matter says organized power is realized power, and you see that show up in the way that it did in November when they flipped Georgia blue, and then in these recent elections of John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, it is just something. And now, look, we have these are historic victories, and now Democrats have to deliver on this mandate. You know, we've got a mandate from the people two times over. And so the response to that, for me, must be bold, systemic policies that are going to have a tangible impact on the lives of workers and families and address these glaring disparities. And I do believe that many Georgians, when they have been robbed of almost 11,000 lives and they saw that Loeffler and Perdue have really been the Bonnie and Clyde of corruption, putting their own personal interest ahead of the interests and the welfare and the safekeeping of Georgians. You know, they know that Mitch McConnell and this Senate, they have been obstructionists at every turn, including to them getting real relief in the way of these $2,000 reoccurring survival checks. Because at this point, that's really what they are. These aren't stimulus checks. These are survival checks.
We know we kept you over, our apologies, but we're glad we did. And we're glad you're safe, Congresswoman. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
Happy New Year.
To you,
and
too.
To you, of course.
Congresswoman Liana Presley represents the 7th Congressional District, and we appreciate her time. Up next, we are opening the lines and asking you, with only 12 days left, is it worth it putting energy into invoking the 25th Amendment or impeaching Donald Trump? Or should we just hold our breath, cross our fingers, and keep the and hope the worst of his actions are behind us? That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie, and the rioters may be gone. You know. I just want to say, Iana Presley, you could not listen to her and not feel what it was like in that building on Wednesday. That was amazing. In any case.
Nimia is asking about this. Are politicians not going to be practicing active shooter drills like the children, the school children, the 5 and 6 year olds of America have been doing? And maybe they will, and maybe this will impact how people feel about gun violence.
The rioters may be gone, but the real threat to America is still lurking about the White House, and the call to have Trump removed is getting louder by the minute. From invoking the 25th Amendment, which would require Mike Pence to come on board, to impeaching him again, to demanding his resignation, which the Wall Street Journal, of all places, suggested, to the mass exodus of his own cabinet, the message is Trump must go. With only 12 days left, as we asked Iana Presley, is there really a point to all these gestures? What difference does it make if DeVos and Elaine Chao resign today? What good will impeaching Trump do now? Will this do anything to protect Americans? We're taking your calls asking you, symbolic as it may be, assuming they can't get anywhere on this with 12 days to go, are these efforts to remove Trump from office worth it? Does it just expose past failures to recognize and do something about his lethal presidency? Or is this the best way to make clear what Donald Trump has done to America on his way out the door? 877-301-8970. I should say, in fairness, Iana Presley believes that the tide is turning and that it's not impossible that Republican votes could turn up in the Senate, assuming the House were to impeach Trump on Wednesday of next week. I just have to say, if I hear one person celebrate the courage of Betsy DeVos and Elaine Chao for covering their own behinds with days to go after 4 years of misogyny and racism, and every other horror that we've seen, all of a sudden it's unacceptable to these people. And for Chau to say, had I stayed, I would have voted to invoke the 25th Amendment. Well, maybe you should have stayed and invoked the 25th Amendment. 877-301-8970. What's that?
Who her husband is?
Well, people, I assume Mitch McConnell is, and Elaine Chao, the transportation, the former, well, she's not former yet,
yeah.
The soon-to-be former transportation secretary, I guess, mm-hmm. are married to each other. 877.
I think that says a lot about her judgment.
301-8970. You know, I don't buy the notion that there will be enough votes in 12 days to remove him from office. But I have to say, I think I come down on the side that it is important that there be some accountability for what he did the other day.
It
I know
is.
The Justice Department is investigating whether to charge him as a result of what happened there. And we also know a police officer, a Capitol Police officer, died as a result of this in the last 24 hours. But my view is Congress has got to do something, even if at the end of the day it doesn't get what they perceive as the desired result, which is the removal of Donald Trump. 877-301-8970.
You know, it is really, when you hear Ayanna Pressley talking about this and you hear other representatives talking about this, the war of the gas masks and everybody's hiding and not knowing what's going to happen, this whole thing. And then you hear about
shots fired.
Exactly. And when President Trump told his followers or that Pence wouldn't do his bidding, and then you hear these chants of these rioters inside the Capitol building say, "Where's Mike Pence? Find Mike Pence. Find Mike Pence. Find." I mean, these people were serious, as I said before. They were plotting for weeks to come with their weapons, and even though you're not supposed to have those kind of weapons inside the Capitol or Washington, D.C., you can't do those kinds of things. But in any case, they were planning it, and it looks to me, I can't believe that law enforcement authorities didn't know this and that they didn't act, as opposed to the tear gas and the dogs and everything else they brought out in Washington, D.C. and other places for Black Lives Matter protests and, of course, all across the country. Anyway, 877-301-8970 is the number, bprwgbh.org. I'm with you, Jim. I think that it's so horrific that the symbolism does matter, even if they can't get anywhere. And I certainly hope somebody's watching him every second. Since he's not going to go to the inaugural, maybe he'll leave town before the end of his term.
Brendan in a car, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Brendan, what's up?
Hey, Jim and Marjorie, thanks for taking my call. I hope you're holding up well during these bad times.
As best as anyone can, I think. What's up with you?
Well, hey, I just wanted to call and say, look, I think, you know, before this week, I was of the opinion this guy lost. Let's ignore him for the next, you know, whatever, how many days through Inauguration Day. When he's out of office, let the criminal process, whatever's going on in New York and maybe elsewhere, kind of play out. Had even entertained the thought, kind of an argument that was out there, that Biden should think about pardoning him, as much as I hate the guy. Is it worth, you know, kind of same decision Gerald Ford made? Is it worth going through with this for the country again? But after this week and after the events of the other day, they absolutely need to remove him from office immediately. However they can do it, it sounds like the 25th Amendment is no longer an option based on what Pence has said. But they need to start impeachment proceedings immediately. And whether or not he gets removed from office will, you know, sort of remain to be seen. But it needs to happen. The process needs to happen. There needs to be accountability. And I think they need to put him up on charges of sedition, inciting a riot, and all the other incredible stuff he's responsible for over the course of this week. And I just don't see how we can do that and not have another president down the road do this again. We need to set an example.
You know, Brendan, you mentioned Mike Pence, and the reports are that he is, quote, highly unlikely that he'd initiate this 25th Amendment removal with the cabinet. I should say that while Mike Pence is getting praise, which I think is completely inappropriate for his performance the other day on Wednesday, because he did essentially what the Constitution requires. I didn't know that was the cause for someone to be celebrated. Did you read the reports, either Brendan or Marjorie, this morning that he was called by Pelosi and Schumer, obviously, to discuss about this, and they were on hold for 25 minutes, and he never took the call? The Vice President of the United States got a call from the two top Democrats in Congress and
didn't
would not even
call either.
Show him the decency to have a conversation. Brendan, thank you for your call and your thoughts as always. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You know, my guess is Joe Biden may not like this because, you know, Biden, the indications are he doesn't want, even though he says his own Justice Department will make their own decisions independently, he doesn't want them prosecuted, are the reports, and that sort of thing, because he wants to unite the country. And actually, impeaching Trump may further divide the country. But as Brendan said, and as Congresswoman Presley said, there's got to be some accountability when you incite riots that lead to the death of five people. And by the way, could have been far, far, far worse than the outcome was, which was pretty damn horrible. 877-301-8970.
Is it Byrne from Harvard? I got that right.
Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I have to agree with the previous caller that the impeachment process should be started because other alternatives are not there. And the reason is that this might have been just a prelude of a hurt and, you know, it was not dignifying. It was not in the concept of Trump to lose. So he might, in the last 12 days, trigger something else in order to make it necessary to keep him in office, in order to run a conflict he might initiate. And this is the biggest risk I see now. And so to put up a signal and show we are vigilant and we are not letting that happen, I think that's why it's important to initiate the impeachment process.
I think you said it well. I think you said it well. And, you know, some people may cite, as I call it, that hostage video he did on Twitter last night, where he had, his major focus will be the transition, a peaceful transition.
Right.
Of course, he doesn't say the name Joe Biden or that Joe Biden won. And while he condemned the violence, again, reading the teleprompter written by somebody else, while he condemns the violence from that happened on Capitol Hill, he never once comes close to apologizing to his role in the violence. In any case, 877-301-8970. Where are we going next?
Thank you for the call,
people,
Byrne.
Back in Brighton. Thank you very much for the call.
We're going
Let's go to Murray
in Newport. Hi, Murray.
Hey, Murray.
Hi. Hi, good morning, and first-time caller, long-time listener, and thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm a retired Navy captain. I've been in the Navy for 30 years, and retired a couple of years ago. And I want to let you know that as officers, we have to take an oath. We don't take an oath to the president. We take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We also administer a very similar oath to the enlisted personnel about, again, protecting the chain of command and following the orders of the officers put in over them. The thing that has happened to me that is so distressing is that the president or whatever, he incited a riot. He had people, and he's in behind this, he had people go up to the Congress to go in and to disrupt what the Constitution has put in place, that the electoral votes would be accounted and would be affirmed by the Congress. He needs to be removed as a Navy officer, 30 years. Again, we have to, the commander-in-chief is our commander, but this is beyond the pale. He has to be removed. And I want to disagree with one thing one caller said. I believe that by removing the president, holding him accountable, and all the other people who have been behind him, will unite the country by showing that democracy works by following the rule of law. This is just, I cannot believe what's happened. Also, too, the president needs to be brought up on murder charges. His inciting this riot led to a Capitol policeman's death and four other people dying. I hope that our Congress will work quickly on this and that more and more people will call me. I don't believe he'll resign. He's delusional. he's psychotic. There's something wrong with this man, and we need now to take action. Ayanna Presley, brave woman, I'm so happy you had her on today, but we need to take action. I've already contacted Senator Reid of Rhode Island, Congressman Cicilline. I'm doing all that I can as a citizen and also as a veteran, but we have to act and act now.
By the way, Cicilline, I should say to you, I'm sure you know this, Murray, is one of the leaders of this effort from down there in Rhode Island. Thank you for a great first call. We really appreciate it, and we hope you'll choose to call us again soon. 877-301-8970. I worry a lot about what he's going to do also. I have no idea. Obviously, there are going to be more pardons. There are strong reports that he's about to pardon himself as well, and obviously that'll be challenged in the court at some point. But there's no clarity, even though most constitutional experts who I've read say they don't believe he has the power to do it, but it surely is unresolved. But other than the pardons, and I don't mean to minimize the significance of them, I don't know. I mean, I would never have predicted he would have urged people to storm Capitol Hill either with his vice president in the damn building. It's, you know,
What does it say to about the guy that he's won't show up at the inaugural?
He is as a human being. It gets back to the thing you say almost every day, and you're so right that about his niece saying Mary Trump talking about how he never lost, and when he did lose, oh, I shouldn't say that. Not that he never lost. Anytime he lost, he could lie, litigate, bully his way out of it. He can't do it here. And he's obviously fallen apart. And the notion that he would be enough of an adult and a patriot to continue this tradition and be there to, well, I guess you don't even shake hands, but to do something when Joe Biden is sworn in, says everything you need to know about Donald Trump.
You know, she's been on, you had her on your show, and she's great, Mary Trump, and she's a psychologist.
She wrote
a book about him. She knew him, that the cruelty he showed to his own family members, including her father, was just,
Her father, right.
Yeah, major skin crawl. But in any case, she sees him now as a trapped rat. She thinks he's got to be removed immediately because she, who does know him better than the rest of us, is really afraid of what he could do in the next few days. I like to think that other people are watching closely to make sure he doesn't go off the deep end, but I have no idea.
Yes, Miller's watching closely. You have nothing.
That's
Jared,
the scary part. Yeah.
By the way, before we go, did you see the video? It's linked on Drudge.
Which one?
Of the riot party where Trump and his kids and his daughters-in-law are dancing, and Trump is not, but Guilfoyle, who's married to one of these, or one of the Trump kids, or the girlfriend of one of the, is dancing while the television cameras in this tent or whatever they're in are broadcasting the rioting on Capitol Hill.
I can't believe I'll miss this.
They have rock and roll music in the back.
Immediately.
It's unbelievable.
We're talking about what to do with Donald Trump with only 12 days left to go before the inauguration. You're listening to 89.7 GBH. We're going to keep taking your calls on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As you know, the whole Massachusetts delegation has called for the removal of Donald Trump immediately with 12 days to go, as have the two Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill. And if the 25th Amendment is not invoked by Vice President Pence in the cabinet, Nancy Pelosi has scheduled, I believe, an impeachment vote for Wednesday of next week, by which time there'd only be whatever it is, 7 days left, I think, maybe off by one. Ayanna Presley said she thinks the tide is turning. There may be Republicans votes for this in the Senate. But if there aren't enough votes, is it still the right thing to do to take the action? And Murray, who has been in the service for, I think he said, 3 decades, says he thinks it actually will be a uniter rather than a divider of the American people. Sharon in Waltham, hi.
Hi, good morning.
And to you. Thank you,
too.
I am agreeing with the last two callers. They actually said what I was thinking. He needs to be held accountable. This is just a dry run for the next thing he has planned. If he gets away with it, what's next?
What do you think the next thing he has planned is? Or is it just something you fear, whatever it is?
I don't know. I have lots of fear of what he's capable of, where he is desperate.
You know, Sharon, thank you for your first call, too. I a lot of people feel as Sharon does, but one of the things we're going to talk about near the end of the show, Marjorie, is there's a wonderful piece on Politico about how, obviously, Donald Trump, I know this is a truism, Donald Trump's primary method of communicating everything is social media.
Right.
If his bans are not just temporary, as they currently are, but permanent because of his incitement behavior, which if he was not a public figure probably would have led to a permanent ban, will that completely eliminate Donald Trump's ability to be an influencer, even as a former president? I think it's a pretty powerful argument.
I worry about these other networks, even though they're small, but the OANs, the America, what is it called?
One America News Network. Record, yeah.
One America Network and Newsmax.
Did you read reliable sources from CNN this morning?
We're going to talk about this later in the show.
But it, say it is, quickly what they were they raised.
It's basically arguing that we have talked a lot about Facebook and Twitter allowing all this false information and lies and these terrible that causes people to believe all these lies. Mm-hmm. He was saying, well, why do we let OAN off the hook? Why do we let Fox News off the hook?
No. Not OAN or Fox News. Why do the platforms on which they run, the cable networks, off the hook, just like if we don't let Facebook and Twitter off the hook, why should Xfinity be off the hook or any other cable provider?
And that's something that people should really, I think, well, we're going to talk about it later in the show, but think about, because people believe this stuff. I mean, we get these emails all the time from people who think it wasn't Trump supporters, it was Antifa.
Well, we got calls yesterday.
We did.
Decent people, I think, who just happen to believe it. Shirley
anyway,
and
let's go to Shirley in Jamaica Plain. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Shirley.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think this is an emergency situation. It's not, I feel like people are wringing their hands and saying, oh, what do we do? We should do everything. We should start impeachment now. We should go to Mike Pence and say, look, this man has a mental disorder or an emotional disturbance. I don't know. We need to treat him. We need to take him away. This is an emergency. I feel like we're all suffering from, battered woman syndrome, where our husbands have been beating us.
Yeah.
And we keep believing that, next time is going to be different. Next time is going to be different. He's going to change. No, he's not. He's not going to change. What he already said on his little Twitter video, the police are with us. He said that. You have to listen to what the man is saying. He's being honest with us in some respects. He's saying those Capitol Police are with us. We all say, well, why did this happen? Well, maybe they really are with him. We don't know. Because he has a way of getting people on his side. He reaches in to other people who have some sort of emotional disturbance, and they say, yeah, man, you speak for us.
Yeah, but Shirley, he got 74 million. I agree with him, a lot of what you said. He got 74 million votes. And that's not, I know a lot of those
it's
people.
Not
I'm sure you
it's
do
not
too.
Trivial.
No, it's not only not trivial. 74 million people are not suffering from emotional disturbance. Some may be, and I agree with you in terms of Trump himself, but a lot of people have bought this hook, line, and sinker.
As we said, we're going to talk about
it. And listen,
about
I know a lot of them. One of them is my husband. So I understand at a really personal level how he reaches in and grabs their attention. His family members, some of my own family members who live in Georgia and in Florida. I understand he's got a broad-based constituency, and he's a master manipulator with his words. The other thing we have to realize is that, wasn't it Mike Flynn who said, you should declare a state of emergency and take over?
Martial
law.
Martial law, and you can order new elections is what Lieutenant General Flynn said. You're totally right. And by the way, I interviewed William Cohen the other night, one of the 10 defense secretaries who signed that letter saying don't let the military get involved in any of Trump's efforts. It was Flynn's pronouncement on television and the meeting Trump had with Flynn about potentially declaring martial law and ordering, I can't believe I'm even saying this, and ordering new elections, one of the motivators for this joint letter.
Well, as I said, we're going to talk about this later, but one of the reasons that 70 million people who are not deranged believe all this stuff is because there is a whole Trump media all across America. It's on television. It's on the radio with Rush Limbaugh. It's on, you know, the Stop the Steal thing that was all over the internet, that was on Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, people put up these fake pictures and they put up these doctored photos and videos and people buy it. And
you think he'll have as much appeal to that constituency when he's no longer has the power of the presidency?
I think that constituency is going to continue because that constituency makes a lot of money, Jim. And I think that's certainly that's what Fox News motivation is about. They know this isn't true, but they're getting rich. Interesting, though, Fox News is owned by Rupert Murdoch, and the Wall Street Journal is run by Rupert Murdoch. I used to work for Rupert Murdoch, so I know the kind of things he wants people to do that are lies, because, you know, it happened to me when a lot of reporters, when I was at the Herald years ago when he was there. And it's interesting, though, that the dichotomy between Fox and the Wall Street Journal.
Calling for him to resign in its editorial. Larry, you have 30 seconds. You're from Fairhaven. I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Shoot.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that I don't think either of these two solutions are going to work out on a practical level because of time. But I think it's extremely important that the DOJ investigate this and prosecute him as soon as the government changes.
Well, it's going to be in the hands of Merrick Garland, sort of one of the great ironies. Couldn't get a hearing to get him to the Supreme Court, but he will make the decision as to whether or not they're federal prosecutor. Of course, if Trump is pardoned, that's a whole other issue. But, Larry, thank you for your thoughts. We appreciate them.
Maybe Merrick Garland could adjudicate Mitch McConnell's parking tickets. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah. Sure, he has very good feelings about Senator McConnell.
Emily Rooney joins us for a famous list of assertions and aggravations and more. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. Every single member of the Massachusetts delegation to Congress is calling for the 25th Amendment to be invoked and for Trump to be removed from office. Congressman Seth Moulton, who sheltered in place on Wednesday, has called the rioters domestic terrorists and traitors incited directly by Trump's rhetoric. He'll join us to discuss what action legislators can take in the final days of the Trump administration.
When Colin Kaepernick took a knee during the national anthem in protest of police brutality, white conservatives called him unpatriotic, then turned around and tried to overturn an election they didn't like the results of. Insurrectionists who condoned violence and raised Confederate flags at the Capitol building on Wednesday were the same ones who criticized mainly peaceful protests for racial justice earlier this year. Callie Cross will join us to discuss the hypocrisy of white conservatives. That's ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. And joining us for a famous list of fixations and fulminations, albeit briefly today, which is very sad, is Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press, which you can catch Friday nights right here on GBH 2 at 7. Hi there, Emily.
Hey, long time
Happy
no
New
talk.
Year. I know. Really, that's right.
It's
Hi.
It's been a while.
So, Emily Rooney, if Marty Walsh becomes the next Secretary of Labor, we're talking about possibly a mayoral free-for-all here in Boston like we had when Tom Menino left town.
Yeah, it will be interesting. But already it's so different because when Mayor Menino left office, it was, you know, so a lot of the usual suspects are ran. But already, you know, you have such a diverse slate. I mean, I'm sure that a whole bunch more people are going to get in. But, you know, it's going to give a leg up to Janie. I mean, it's, you know, people don't know her and they'll get to know her.
Well, you know, one of the things that's amazing to me is, and I think that that Mayor Walsh could do one hell of a job in this position. And right. I think he really gets it. And I think it's a fine choice. You wonder about Marty Walsh running this huge bureaucracy as opposed to being, to quote Ayanna Pressley, the Dorchester kid.
I know. You know, yeah. I was thinking today, because we're all very, we can honestly say that we're very fond of him. But
yeah, personally, I'm huge.
He has such a homeboy quality.
Yeah.
And he is, no offense, Marty, but a cultural rube. And, you know, going to Washington and just instantly being a part of the fracas, even if you're not, you know, on the social scene, forget that. I just mean part of that, as you put it, like a huge bureaucracy. It will be interesting to see how he maneuvers that.
Let me clarify. I don't, the place that you and I part, I don't think he'll have a difficult time running that. I think he'll really good at it.
No, I agree with that.
I just meant it's like you can't take
we're saying the same thing.
The boy out of Dorchester.
Exactly.
And I think he's going to miss it in a lot of ways.
And just being thrown into that, I think it'll be, at the job itself, I think it'll be fantastic. That's not my point. It's that whole Washington thing. Yeah, I know.
Well, you know all these movies that have all these ridiculous Boston accents?
Yeah, oh, my God.
He's got the real one, and it's going to be great, and we're going to hear a million things about, here's the mayor of Boston, listen to him talk, and all that kind of thing. But you know what I also think? Marty Walsh is recovering alcoholic. He's been sober for many years. And in person, and in that movie about City Hall that
Fred Weissman,
yes. When you hear him talk about recovery, whether it's alcohol or drugs or whatever, he's so good at that.
I know. He almost would have been good at something along that line in Washington, too. I know.
A sidelight is kind of the guy who really understands what it is to, hit rock bottom and be down and out.
Well,
back up.
When you say, Emily, it would have been great if he had some responsibility in that area. He does.
He will,
Tons of workers
in this
country.
Yeah, have all those kinds of problems.
Have addiction issues. Yeah. And I have to say, I have never met a public figure or encountered one who is as open and honest. The scene, I mean, we all know him pretty well, so we've heard him talk about it personally with us and others, obviously with everybody. That scene in City Hall, when he's talking to those veterans, it was just so moving and so real. Mm-hmm. And,
he's so fluid. He's the same no matter what topic he's dealing with. You know, I was looking back at the past 6 years and just thinking, well, was there anything? Did he have any pitfalls? The only thing that he even came close, of course, was that alleged shakedown of the Boston Calling concert when his two City Hall people got charged basically with extortion, and then judge threw it out. But I mean, he stayed clear of that. He didn't get involved in it at all. I mean, I'm sure he was emotionally wrecked about it because there were two of his people, but
last thing before we leave this, this every report in the last 24 hours, Joe Biden and Marty Walsh have been close friends for a long time. I remember, and we've discussed this with Mayor Walsh as recently as maybe a month or two ago. I remember, do you remember Walsh was elected the first time and Biden called Marty Walsh?
Oh, yeah, no, didn't he call the other guy Walsh? He called somebody
I think he called another Marty Walsh, who I think was in Dorchester, and I guess he got the wrong contact. Ultimately, he made it to the mayor-elect at that point. And
congratulations. Walsh, the big guy, the heavyset guy who was Democrat. Anyway,
John Walsh.
John Walsh.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, John Walsh, who now is the chief of staff in Washington and was the campaign manager.
I thought that's who he called. I don't know.
For Ed Markey. In any case, since we have an abbreviated session today, here is why Emily is here.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter.
I have absolutely no interest.
So,
all right. Yeah, I've been home alone, for the last couple of weeks. My daughter did come visit after two COVID tests later. So we spent a lot of time before the TV set, and she's really good at maneuvering all this stuff. And I have to give partial credit to Paula Evans for this list because she tweeted out a thing on Twitter. She said, movies I have to stop and watch. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's exactly what my daughter and I have been doing for 2.5 weeks. No matter what else you're doing, you got to stop. So, and then the other thing I saw was a little item in the paper that the most watched movie over this whole COVID crisis has been Moonstruck.
Oh!
And of course, I had to watch that. So these are a list of movies. I just watched it.
Me too, like 3 days ago.
I forgot, me too.
Last weekend.
We must have been watching it at the same moment. So these are, of course, these are movies that I had to stop and watch no matter what else I was doing. You know, Home Alone, of course. So watch that. I think I watched that one twice. It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
The Sting is one of my all-time favorite movies. I can't get enough of it.
I love The Sting. Robert Redford, Paul Newman, and Robert Shaw.
Yes,
that was
Robert
the captain. It was Quentin Jaws.
Well, of course, I had to watch Jaws, too, so I'll scratch that.
Of course.
Of course, I had to watch Jaws. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Love that.
Speed. I can't get enough of that movie. I don't know why. You know, what's her name?
No. Who's in that?
Keanu Reeves and...
okay.
And, oh, my God. Sandra Bullock.
Bullock.
Yes. Yeah, well, the bus is out of control.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, my
gosh.
I've seen the previews.
And it's just one, you know, speed scene after another. It's great. Speed. Shawshank Redemption. Watch that every time.
Yeah, that is one of the best ever.
And this one, I've probably seen it 47 times. The River Wild.
I don't know that one.
I've never
with
seen
Meryl
that.
Streep and Kevin Bacon.
Really?
I didn't see it.
Oh, my.
You know, before you leave the Shawshank Redemption, was that not written by Stephen King? I'm 90% sure.
Really? I'd have to check that.
It was. Thank you, John Parker.
It was,
and
really.
Talk about unlike what you expect from Steve is brilliant.
I
one
know,
of his greatest
great.
Things ever. Yeah.
All right.
Well, let's get back to River Wild. Tell us about that.
Oh my gosh, it's Meryl Streep and David Strawn, and they're not getting along. They're married, and they have two kids, and so she's going to go on this river trip, and David then decides to go at the last time. And then they run into these guys who have just robbed a bank or whatever they've done. And it's Kevin Bacon and two sidekicks. And they basically co-opt their raft and they kidnap this whole family. And then it's this wild tale after that. It's great.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's a little bit violent, but it's wonderful.
You watched all these during the break?
Hey, keep going. Last of the Mohicans.
Oh, my God.
Watched that. Love that movie. Dances with Wolves. Watched that.
Oh, my God.
All of these. Field of Dreams. Love it.
Field of Dreams.
Indiana Jones and the Lost Ark.
Oh, my God.
That's the only one of those Indiana Jones ones that I really like. Thelma and Louise.
Thelma and Louise. That was a good
one. And these two Meg Ryan movies, Sleepless in Seattle and You've Got Mail.
Absolutely.
Addicted to those.
Sleepless in Seattle is the orgasm one. The Rob Reiner orgasm one. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
All right, so you know
that's when Harry Met Sally. That's when Harry Met Sally.
Oh, you're right, when Harry Met Sally.
How about Witness? Do you remember that one?
The with Amish. Paul Newman?
No. Witnesses with
Harrison
Ford.
Ford.
Same guy.
Harrison
as, you know,
Ford. Yeah.
Where
the
Amish
family?
Kid.
Yeah.
Witnesses. The
is that
murder.
Good?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
only have time for a couple more.
Oh, darn. All right. Well, I kept revisiting these. The Sound of Music and The King and I. My daughter loves The King and I.
Oh, my God. But, Yul Brynner. Thank
all right,
you.
Hold on.
Yeah.
So, hold on. Oh, the Sixth Sense. I don't know why. Love that one.
Yeah.
Mrs. Doubtfire, because my mother loved that movie.
Mrs. Doubtfire is pretty good.
And, of course, as Jared would know, my all-time favorite that I stop, even if it's the one with the commercials in it, Dirty Dancing.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I'm obsessed.
Well, by the way, let me just say, you started with Moonstruck.
Yeah,
I will
Moonstruck.
Do my invitation of Vincent Gardenia coming home after he's been out all night.
Yeah.
And Olympia Dukakis, his wife says, where have you been? He says, I don't know where I've been. I don't know where I'm gone. I'll say no more. And he walks upstairs and goes through his room.
And that whole scene at the kitchen table, she says, have I been a good wife? And he goes, yeah, I want you to stop seeing her. And he slams the table, gets in and goes, okay.
It's great. Hey, quickly, what are you doing tonight, Emily Rooney?
Well, we're doing a whole roundup of what happened on Wednesday. You know, basically, I'm saying that while the Capitol Police were not prepared, the media was certainly prepared for what happened on Wednesday. But they also became, you know, a target of a lot of those people. So we're looking at that. We're looking at the social media ban of President Trump and whether this is really just the start of something and whether maybe they were preempting themselves because there's going to be more regulation on social media under a new administration. And then Adam Riley is looking at this whole thing with how to report that other people are saying that the mobs were instigated by Antifa when you know it wasn't, but you know. People are saying it, and do you give oxygen to those lies by reporting it, or how do you go about that?
So. We'll be watching. Sorry, it was abbreviated today. It's great to talk
Emily,
to you.
Emily, that was a great list.
Yeah, well, I got more, but it's embarrassing. Bye.
I'm going to watch Moonstruck this weekend, actually, because of her. That's
okay,
great.
Bye.
See
God.
You later.
It's great. It stands up, as they say. Okay. Up next, we're going to continue our conversation about this week's acts of domestic terrorism and what happens to the president with Congressman Seth Moulton.
No, he we're not, actually. Are we? No, we're not. We're not. We're going to talk about the frontline doc with Ramona Diaz. Yep.
Okay. My apologies. My third screw up of the day, Jim. I'm doing well.
You're entitled.
We're talking about the Philippines President Duterte, whether the pen is mightier than the president there. It's a new documentary, and that is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio. Sorry about that, you guys.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marge Regan. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's escalating attacks on the press is the focus of Ramona Diaz's spectacular new documentary, A Thousand Cuts. In it, Diaz tells the story through one of Duterte's prime targets, journalist Maria Ressa. As an independent journalist, Ressa has been at the forefront of chronicling Duterte's brutal war on drugs and on many of his people. The consequences that she's paid include harassment, arrests, and a cyber libel conviction that could send her to prison for years. Tonight, A Thousand Cuts will premiere on Frontline. You can find it at PBS at 8 o'clock, and streaming at pbs.org/frontline. The broadcast premiere includes a roundtable discussion with Christian Amanpour, Maria Ressa, and Ramona herself, who joins us online. And I should say, she is an Emerson grad. Ramona, congratulations. The film is spectacular. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah,
pleasure.
Thank you. Yes, Emerson.
That's right. We can thank Emerson for your being able to do this unbelievable work, Maria. It was great. Obviously, the parallels to what's happening here to a lesser degree are significant. But I want to talking about Maria Ressa. I mean, people were threatening online to, you know, rape her, behead her, just gruesome stuff. And she's this journalist, the independent journalist that you profile. But she seemed to show almost a supernatural calm in the face of all this terror. Tell us more about this woman.
Yes. It is incredible. And, you know, we followed her immersively, right, for close to 2 years. And you really can't keep that up if that it's really not you, mm-hmm. right? If it's something you take on. But she is like that, and just from observing her, I think what happens is that she goes back to what she is, really. She's a journalist. She's a reporter. So it's almost like even if things are happening to her, she's able to take that observer view and look at it from a journalist's point of view, which gives her clarity. She said she's able to do that. It's like stepping off and looking at it like almost like an outer body experience for her. And I think that's what gives her clarity of thought. If you see in the film, the last scene, actually, when she's convicted,
yes.
she does a presser right after, right? The press conference right after. And she's so clear on what she has to say. And it's always like that. And the first time I observed, I was watching, I'm like, what is going on? How could she do that? But and I think that's it. She goes back. It's her go-to being a journalist, and it's really helped her. Also just this very calm person, right?
So I guess so.
She's not just calm. I want to add to what you two said. She's got a great sense of humor.
Oh, she's
and a
great.
Spirit,
and, yeah,
and I mean,
humble.
Even under threats.
I mean, her sister in that great scene was in tears, so upset about her sister's fate and her future, and she's facing, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, 60 years in this prison term. We're not fooling around here.
Yeah, well, right now she's been convicted of cyber libel, and that she's been sentenced to up to 6 years in prison. She's appealing that, but she has 9 other cases, right? She has 9 cases and 8 others that have not been resolved. So cumulative is 100 years, actually, if she's found guilty on all of those cases, of all of the suits against her by the government. Yeah.
You know, we should say, if I can, just to give a little background, the name of the organization she runs, the journalism organization, is Rappler. And not only is Ressa incredible, her young journalists.
Oh, my God.
Talk about courage. And by the way, this is not just a Trumpian figure. We'll get to Trump in a minute. This, you know, it's one thing, and I'm sure you appreciate this, Ramona. When you read Duterte threatening to kill people involved in drugs, it's bad. when you hear his voice saying it, as we do throughout your film, and also saying without blinking an eye, he'll kill journalists if he has to. It is amazing that they're able to do their work. Again, the young journalist, Ressa herself, in the face of these constant threats, not just to their freedom, but to their lives.
No, it is incredible. And some of them, as you said, like, they're all very young. Some of them, it's their first gig out of college.
Yeah.
Right? The Rappler really likes to nurture. As Maria says, I don't know if she says it in the film, but she said it in past interviews, they really hire the best 20-somethings who are digital natives.
Yeah.
Because Rappler lives online. So they do understand the language of the digital age. They're so used to, like, just taking out their phones, going live when things are happening to them. Like, you saw Pia Renata, when she was, like, one of the, she's a reporter for Rappler who covers the president and who covers the Malacanang Palace, which is the Philippines White House. She was banned from covering the president. Just one day, she was banned, and she took out her phone, went live on Facebook, and that's how the entire country knew she was bad. But it's this go-to. It's instinctual. And I really think those young reporters are Maria's great legacy, right? She really, really has trained them to, as she says, hold the line. You're there. You have to report, and you have to do your job. You know, that's what you're there for. It's incredible. It is incredible.
We're talking to Ramona Diaz. The new frontline documentary is A Thousand Cuts. Let's play a little bit of sound from the incredibly tense interview between the journalists we're speaking about, Maria Ressa of Rappler, and President Duterte, that's shown in this film.
Is it important that people be afraid of you?
Fear. Yes.
But, Mr. President, as president, you now also defend the Constitution.
Yes.
And so, again, this is a contradiction from our last interview. You break the law. You threatened to break the law. You said you had killed it a year ago, right? You told me that. And yet, you now have the task of keeping the rule of law. And you said you would do that also. How do you...
Because the rule of law, there must be fear.
Must be fear.
And he's got this cult-like following, too. Right?
He does. You mean Duterte?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Now, his approval rating is still, and that is a difference, right, between, I guess, if we're going to bring up Trump. Duterte has still in the 80%, if you're to believe the polls, right, or the surveys, the latest is still very high, in spite of his response to the pandemic, which has been such a failure. but he still does, if you were to believe it. Right, because these surveys are taken in the privacy of your homes. They knock on doors, and if there is fear already, what are you going to tell these people, that you're against the president?
Exactly.
Not so much, right? Yeah. So fear is not accounted for in those surveys, and I think that's key. But yes, if you were to believe them, he still has a. Well, he's a populist, right? I mean, that's how he came on the scene. He really plugged into the discontent of the people, and they're valid. You know, the gap between the rich and the poor in the Philippines is humongous. It's a chasm. You know, that people, it's amazing. So he basically, like a populist, he said, we have common enemies, and those common enemies are the elite and the media, and I will revenge whatever you're going through. I'm not only going to make your life better, but I'm going to go after them because they have put you in this situation. And that, it's like a language, it's just, it's like street justice, right? So people really thought that was so refreshing and different from other politicians. And a lot of people signed on and are still signing on. They understand that language. They understand, yes, I want revenge. I don't want my life to change. I also want them to suffer because I'm suffering. And sounds familiar?
Well, you know, I don't know if Trump was an inspiration for the film or just as a viewer. Almost every scene one thinks of Donald Trump as, you know, from the social media disinformation campaigns, to the use of the term like fake media, his coarse language. He also talks about his genitalia, just like Donald Trump has time to time. And the reason it really strikes, particularly now, and I know you know this, Ramona, but most of our listeners obviously haven't seen the film yet. Let me just play this soundbite again. Here's Maria Ressa speaking before an audience about the sickness of her democracy, and it's obviously what gave the film its name, A Thousand Cuts. Here she is.
What we're seeing is death by a thousand cuts of our democracy, and it is done. Then think about the bleeding, right? Little cuts to the body politic, to the body of Philippine democracy. And when you have enough of these cuts, you are so weakened that you will die. We at Rappler, I've said this, it's been a year now since I've said this. We will not duck, we will not hide, we will hold the line. Join us.
You know, as somebody who spent a couple of years, as you say, with her, and obviously in the Philippines, other than the murders, Trump is Duterte. Duterte is Trump. Is that not a fair statement?
Yeah, they're both. Yes and no. I suppose they're very similar, as you see in the film. But also the difference, I think, is Duterte has been a politician all his life. Yeah. Right?
He was mayor
of Davao. Yeah. For a very long time. So he understands politics. He understands policy, which makes it even a little bit more dangerous. And he's a lawyer, too. So he can really talk circles around you. So I think that's the big difference. But they are both, they do both use this populist language. And that makes them very similar. And the effects are similar.
You know, Ramona Diaz, I didn't realize until I saw the film that that Maria had spent much of her young life actually in Jersey, in a town in Jersey where I've been quite a few times because I'm from Philadelphia, not far away. She asked herself in the film the question that I was wondering if you would address, and you did. Why did she go back to the Philippines when she knew how much risk there was? There's this great scene where she gets off the plane, and the second she's off the plane, all the cops are grabbing her, and she's smiling. And I mean, she is amazing. But why did she go back to the Philippines? What's her answer?
You know, that's Maria. She has to go back because she has to, for her, she has to clear her name, right? She's been known all these years. She spent years building this reputation as a good journalist. Suddenly, in the Philippines, she is a convicted cyber libelist, or you know, she's being convicted of all these so-called crimes, and she feels she has to clear her name. She also feels like one day, you know, she has to. It's bearing witness, or she has to bear witness again. She's a journalist. I think it's what keeps her going back. I mean, right now she's there. There's a travel ban now on her, so she can't leave. But I think it is her sense of justice that keeps her going back. She is going to stand, and she's gonna prove her innocence. And to her, that's very, very important.
Well, you tell her story beautifully, and she is really one hell of an inspiration, I should say, to all of us. I mean, she is just amazing. Congratulations on the film, and thanks so much for spending time with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, too. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ramona. That's the voice of filmmaker Ramona Diaz. Her documentary, A Thousand Cuts, premieres on Frontline tonight at 8 o'clock on PBS. Excuse me. If you want to see how bad things can get, and this is a real trainer in that. It's streaming also pbs.org/frontline. And the broadcast also includes a roundtable discussion with Christiane Amanpour, Maria Ressa, and filmmaker Ramona Diaz. So you can see that as well. Thanks again to Ramona Diaz for joining us.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie Egan. In a minute or two, we're going to be joined by Congressman Seth Moulton. Before we are, Marjorie, I just want to say one more thing about the film. The timing is unbelievable. And I know I brought it up, but I assume you had the same reaction. There are shades of Donald Trump, again, without the death threats and the actual murders, which Duterte prides himself on. It was almost a movie about Donald Trump, didn't you think, or did you?
Yeah, and it was also a movie about how social media distorts people's views of reality. And obviously that's happening here in spades. So it was the same sort of situation, I think.
You know, it's also, while we praise, I think, appropriately, journalists, people in our business who do the right thing and ask tough questions of people in power, you compare that in this setting with what this woman has got to live with every, and her young staff have got to live with every day. Whereas I said, Duterte literally saying on the record without any hesitation, he'll kill to a journalist's face, I'll kill you if it turns out that that it's appropriate in my justifications, in my mind. So you should really watch this thing tonight, 1,000 Cuts on PBS. It's a terrific documentary, and the timing is terrific. Do you want to say something? You were looking at me. We're waiting for the congressman.
No, I was going to say, we're waiting for the congressman. There was another story you mentioned to me earlier this morning that I thought perhaps you might want to mention.
Go right ahead.
About Curt Schilling.
Curt Schilling, right, the Red Sox, who's awaiting yet another Hall of Fame vote. And he tweeted this morning. Curt Schilling has been known to occasionally do a controversial thing or two. He tweeted right after the Trump mob had been pushed back out of the Capitol. This is what Curt Schilling tweeted. You cowards sat on your hands, did nothing, while liberal trash looted, rioted, and burned for Air Jordans and big screens. Sit back, shut up, and watch folks start a confrontation for expletive deleted that matters, meaning like the rioters, like rights, democracy, and the end of government corruption. We'll talk to Callie Crossley about that in a couple of minutes. Curt Schilling speaking up on what happened on Wednesday. Speaking of Wednesday, on Wednesday, Congressman Seth Moulton, along with other members of Congress, were rushed to the Capitol complex to avoid the mob of Trump rioters running rampant through the halls of the Capitol. In a piece he wrote for CNN, the congressman writes, I expected violent assault on democracy as U.S. Marine in Iraq. I never imagined it as a U.S. congressman in America. Congressman Moulton joins us in line to talk about what he's describing as acts of domestic terrorism and why he's among members of Congress demanding that President Trump be removed from office immediately. Congressman Moulton represents the state's 6th congressional district. Congressman, it's good to talk to you as always.
Good to talk with you.
Well, Congressman, we talked to Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley earlier today, and so I'll start with you with what I asked her. Is it worth it at this point when it seems like there's very little time to pursue the impeachment of the president? The 25th Amendment seems unlikely. I mean, is it worth it?
It's always worth it to do the right thing. It's never too late to uphold the law. And the reason it's especially important here is because the world is watching. Future generations of Americans are watching what we will do today. And future presidents will look at this precedent and know that no matter what happens, no matter what time it is, everyone has to follow the law. I mean, if you announced, Marjorie, that you were retiring or leaving the job at GBH and you know, stole a few computers on the way out the door, I don't think people would say, oh, don't worry, you know, Marjorie's on her way out anyway. We'll let her run off with the loot, you know? No. You'd be held accountable. Yeah. And the president needs to be held accountable, too.
You know, Congressman Moulton, you have traveled the world. And one of the things I've thought a lot about, and I'm guessing you have too, is we, in most of our history, have been a country that serves as a model of democracy for the rest of the world and have been at appropriate times, maybe not the last 4 years, a scold of those who subvert democracy, oppress their people, on and on like that. When a congressman or a leader like you accuses another leader in another country of doing things like that that are undemocratic and subversions of good government. And that oppressor turns to you and says, I'd worry about your own house before you worry about mine. What do you say to him? What does anybody say to him or her after these last number of years, and particularly after this last week?
And this happened to me less than a year ago when I was in Cambodia. And Cambodia is a country that is strategically important to us. It's a country that China and the United States are essentially fighting to get on our side. And they have some serious issues with human rights. I was trying to walk the fine line of encouraging them to be our ally while also being critical of some of their internal politics right now. And when high ministers in Cambodia looked at me and said, you know, how can you criticize us when you have a president doing this or a president doing that? There's honestly not much to say. It's incredibly embarrassing, but more importantly, it completely undermines our credibility as the supposed leader of the free world. And I can't tell you how many messages, texts, emails I've received from people all over the globe in the last 24 to 36 hours talking about this and saying how everyone is watching the United States right now. Everyone is watching how we handle this vicious affront to democracy right here at home. They're watching. And that's why it's so important that we do the right thing.
Well, even if you do the right thing, unless they have epiphanies, 147 of your House Republican colleagues, and I can never remember six or seven of your Senate Republican colleagues, even after the insurrection, were willing to try to overturn the results of the election. So you do the right thing, and the other leaders of the other principal party in America do the wrong thing. So how do you deal with that?
Let me tell you, they're having epiphanies. They're having epiphanies.
You believe that?
I've heard it from them. Oh, absolutely. That's not the problem, Jim. The problem is what they need is not an epiphany. They need to find some courage. That's what they need to grow is some courage. They need to find some courage to do the right thing because they know the right thing to do here. Some of them have told it to me in private. I had a colleague who happened to be a fellow veteran from the other side of the aisle. One of the people who very embarrassingly was voting against certification of the Electoral College. I mean, absolutely doing the wrong thing in the Congress in the past couple days. One of the people essentially inciting. By the way, I apologize. My daughter just walked in from preschool, so there's a little bit of a ruckus in the background.
Then it's okay if that's the reason. Go ahead.
It's always a good excuse, right? But look, one of the people who was inside the Capitol inciting by his actions what was going on outside and what eventually spilled in through the windows. And yet even he said, this has gone too far. This man needs to be relieved of command. I think he used the term relieved of command, not just because he's a fellow veteran, but because of the single most important job of Donald Trump right now, which is commander in chief. Commander in chief, the number one responsibility is to keep us safe. And not only did he fail to keep us safe, our government safe, our people safe, the American people safe, he actually incited violence against us. He incited a violence against our government.
You know,
so I think that Republicans are realizing this, but the question is just whether they'll have the courage to say it in person. And you know, and this goes back to something I've said before, which is that a lot of people, especially a smart place like Boston, where everyone's always thinking, right? They come up to me and they say, "Seth, what's going on with Congress? Come on, man. How come Congress is so stupid? How can it not believe in climate change? You know, or today, how can these members of Congress not believe statistics, basic election results, basic math?" And I've always said, you know, I've actually been impressed by how smart many of my colleagues are. What's lacking in Congress isn't intelligence. It's courage. It's just the courage to speak the truth It's just the courage to do the right thing and then go back home to your constituents who may disagree with you and be willing to stand up at a town hall and explain to them why it's right.
We're talking with Congressman Seth Moulton. Congressman, what was your experience on Wednesday? Where were you when this all took place?
So, like the majority of members of the House, I was in my office getting ready to vote, because what they asked was that only members of the states, representatives of the states in question, be on the floor. But as they were going through this debate about Arizona, I was ready to just walk across the street. My office is the front door to my building is, 150 yards from the Capitol, just across the street. And of course, we saw all these rioters coming up the street and heard them outside the window and were getting alerts about what was going on. We got the order that two of the buildings right next to mine were evacuated. I later learned because a pipe bomb was found between them.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And we saw the reports of folks trying to break into this mob trying to break into the Capitol, and to make a long story short, we just sat there. I looked outside. I walked down the hallway and looked at the scene, and I realized, wow, there is not a single Capitol police officer anywhere in sight. So obviously the mob is focused on the Capitol right now. But if they turn around and go 50 feet in the other direction, they can walk right in this office building, walk right down the hall to my office and to hundreds of other offices, and pretty basically have totally free reign. So a few minutes later, when there was this heavy, heavy rapping at the door, I didn't know who it was, whether it was a rioter or the police. They shouted police, and what do you do in that situation? Well, I stood up tall and I just opened the door, and sure enough, it was the Capitol Police trying to round everybody up and get us down to a secure location where they put hundreds of members of the House together in a room to protect us, because they obviously did not have the coverage to properly protect us in our offices.
Can I speak about that room for a second? I didn't realize that's where you ended up. I'm sure you know Susan Wild, who's a congresswoman, a colleague of yours from Pennsylvania. I heard her interviewed the other night on CBS, and she was talking, about being in that room, which she said concerned her. She wouldn't say where it was for obvious reasons. She said it concerned her because there were so much. She said a couple hundred members of Congress in a very small space. And that was troubling to me. What was much more troubling to me is she said a large number of Republicans, particularly freshman Republican members of Congress, were not wearing masks.
How
is that? Isn't there a mandate? Isn't there a requirement that members of Congress wear a mask in the building?
No, that's right. And I mean, to be fair, it wasn't a large number. It was probably a dozen and a half.
That's a large number to me.
Not a large percentage.
Okay.
A large number and a large percentage. Most Republicans were wearing masks, but it was the usual suspects, these Trump acolytes, including several of the freshmen who had just been elected, like this QAnon believer from Georgia. I don't even want to say her name. They're all in a corner, along with several of the organizers, the Tea Party folks like Jim Jordan, who were essentially organizing this insurrection inside the House.
Did he get the Medal of Freedom the other day, Jim Jordan, Mr. Insurrection? Didn't he get the nation's highest civilian honor with Devin Nunes, I think, the other day. But go ahead. I'm sorry, Congressman.
God, I wouldn't want to be in a room with Devin Nunes if my life depended on it. But
Okay. Can I move on to something else here for a second?
Let me tell you this story really quick, because want to tell you this story. So I watched as several very polite colleagues of mine walked up to these Republicans and said, "Can you please put your masks on?" And then there were some who actually got masks themselves and extra masks from somewhere and came over and offered them to them and put on these masks. And they didn't do anything. So then I just decided, you know what? I'm just going to walk over and take out my phone, which I did, and started taking pictures of them standing there without their masks.
Great.
And they flipped out. This woman, Mary Miller, I think it was, from this Trumpite from Illinois. She comes in and jumps right in my face and starts screaming at me, of course, with her mask off, and says, you know, who the hell do you think you are? Like, I don't need, only 1% of COVID people die of COVID. Only 1%. I mean, I guess she feels that, you know, with 1% of America, 3 million people die. That's totally fine in her book. But anyway, she's screaming at me, and a Republican who's a friend of mine comes over and tries to, you know, hey, stop it. This is Seth. He's a friend of mine and everything. And, you know, please don't take pictures of us. What's the problem? What are you scared of? For what it's worth, I looked back a few minutes later and most of them were wearing their masks.
Well, I guess it works, doesn't it?
You know, can I ask
about Republicans not having courage?
We're talking to Seth Moulton.
And they're in this room trying to make a political point. You take out a camera and they don't even have the courage to continue making their stupid point. Sorry.
When you talk about the courage or lack thereof of some of your Republican colleagues, is it that they are afraid of the Trump base that we talk about endlessly, or is it that they believe this stuff too because they're watching Fox News or they're seeing stuff on their Facebook pages? I mean,
I think that there are a few of them that are believers.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are a few that are believers. I mean, you know, I mean, Devin Nunes, I don't know what he believes. I feel like he's got children's books in his office to keep him busy at night. But he I think, actually believes this crap, you know?
Yeah.
But most of them know better. Most of them know better. And so, yeah, look, if everyone actually voted their conscience, you know, you'd probably have about, I don't know, at least 400 votes to impeach in the House. And then maybe there's 35 who actually believe what the president's peddling. But most of them know what to do, is know what the right thing is. They know the facts. I mean, what they'll say to me, the thoughtful ones who will actually admit it, is, look, Seth, I've got 96% Trump approval rating in my district. You know, the most thoughtful argument I will give to them is that they sometimes say, look, if I don't do this, I get beaten in a primary by someone who's even more extreme, who's even more dangerous. And I mean, there's some truth to that. That can happen. But what they need to do is say, no, I'm going to change minds.
Yeah,
that's why we have a representative democracy, not just a straight democracy where every single person gets a vote. Like, I'm going to go back as their representative and you know what? I've had to do that a lot in Massachusetts. A lot of times in Massachusetts, there are a lot of unpopular votes that I've taken. I have to go back and explain them. I mean, I remember standing before a packed congregation at a temple in Marblehead when I was supporting the Iran nuclear deal. And awful lot of people, especially in the Jewish community, were opposed to it. And I stood there for an hour and a half and explained my position and answered question after question. And I know for a fact, because many people have told me subsequently, that I changed a lot of minds. But I also know that there were people there whose minds I didn't change. But they at least respected me for having the conversation. And that's what we need to do. We need representatives like that in the Congress.
By the way, I don't usually give advice to Congress people, but if you didn't change their mind, just walk over and take their picture. I mean, that'll take care, I think, of the whatever.
Maybe that'll work.
Hey, Congressman Moulton, one last thing I wanted to bring up with you. I've been searching around the last week or so. When I started reading criticism of Joe Biden's selection of Dennis McDonough as the new head of the Veterans Administration, I thought of you. And I searched around because I was surprised I didn't see a comment from you. A number of veterans leaders are not happy about his lack of relevant experience. And, well, I shouldn't even say what their reasons are. How do you feel about the appointment by President-elect Biden?
Look, I'll be completely honest with you, Jim. I'm conflicted because I know Dennis McDonough. I do think he's very smart and very competent. I think he has a lot of the skills that are required to help turn around the VA. But the flip side of it is that, you know, you're being asked to be the leader of a very specific community of Americans that you need to speak to, you need to relate to. And I do think that fundamentally it would be better to have a veteran in that job. And we know that veterans actually do very well in business. I mean, there are a lot of Fortune 500 CEOs who are veterans. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like it would be that hard to find someone who has all of Dennis McDonough's qualifications, but also has an ability through his or her experience to actually speak to this community in a real meaningful way.
Seth Moulton, it is a pleasure to talk to you as always, and we're very glad.
Been back on enough. You and your, enough,
I know.
Enough,
and your colleagues are. No, I know who you are. I know who you are. Trust me. We really appreciate your time, Congressman, and stay safe and stay in touch.
Jim and Marjorie, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Happy New Year, so Congressman. Congressman Seth Moulton represents the state's sixth, that is, congressional district. Up next, how social media made the Trump revolt a reality. Tech writer Andy Anatko joins us for that and more on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Before we move on to this next segment, I want to say one of our colleagues is monitoring Governor Baker's press conference. And for those concerned about schools this season, the governor says his administration will make weekly COVID-19 pool testing available to all schools within the next month. And his quote is, "This new resource will give districts the ability to bring more kids back to the classroom." And it is Mass Life Science Center is behind the effort. The Commissioner of Education says weekly testing will be in addition to rapid tests currently provided for schools, and they're in the process of finalizing a contract with a testing service. So while members of Congress are trying to use constitutional means to keep Trump from doing more harm to the nation, the tech giants might have found a better way to do that, banning the president, at least temporarily, from social media. Joining us to go over the latest headlines at the intersection of tech and Trump is Andy Anatko. I'm laughing at myself. It's pretty pathetic. He's a tech writer and blogger. You can find his work at Anatko.com, and you can follow Andy at IHNATKO. Andy Anatko, good to talk to you as always.
Thank you. Not the first time the word pathetic has been used in one of my introductions.
No, Andy Anatko.
You're a funny guy, Andy Anatko. But
thank you.
You're welcome.
So it's good that we can still laugh.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. We do have a good story here at the end that we'll get to later on. Anyway, tell us about what exactly is going on with these social media bans. Who's doing what to whom here?
It really does seem to be finally, at long last, a dogpile on all of Trump's social media accounts. Twitter inflicted a 12-hour ban that just was lifted last night, provocated on that, hey, you're all good people, we love you, video that he sent to the insurrectionists. Mm-hmm. Facebook has banned him from its platform and from Instagram indefinitely, but at least until the inauguration. He's had his platform on YouTube suspended with videos taken down. Twitch has been taken down. Shopify, his official account, he can't process things via PayPal. Snapchat has taken him off. So a lot of stuff is coming down at the same time. He just got his access to Twitter restored last night at around 7-something p.m., and he immediately posted what is being interpreted as the first-hand, like, semi-concession speech. But even so, he seemed to be very, very much aware that if he loses the Twitter platform permanently, which could very much happen, remember that he's only skating by despite his violations of content practices, because Twitter has basically given him a public interest policy pass that all expires as soon as he stops being president. If he is deplatformed from Twitter, he loses access to 87 million followers on Twitter, and he probably is not going to get that kind of attention on alternate platforms like Parler. But anyway, so but he was also back at it this morning, tweeting about how yes, our 75 million great American patriots who voted for me, America First, and make America great again, will have a giant voice in the future. So I don't anticipate that he's going to be on that platform much longer because he just can't keep his yap shut in keeping up with the terms of user policy there.
Yeah, I want to talk. I mean, Michelle Obama is amongst those who's saying a permanent ban is appropriate. I want to get to that in a minute because I know you have mixed feelings as a free speech kind of guy, and I like to think that I am too. Staying within the, the public leader exception. I know it's not called that, but whatever it is that allows in the interests of public dialogue or something for public leaders to go beyond what mere mortals could do. Is there any contemplation of, I don't mean eliminating that exception, for lack of a better expression, but changing the rules of that exception so there's a little less latitude around violence and incitement than there currently is? Or is it all just going to be on a case-by-case basis?
Twitter certainly hasn't made any statements toward that effect. However, I think it's almost certain that every single major platform, Twitter included, is going to have to start reevaluating its policies, many of which were instituted for very, very good reasons. I do agree with their public interest policy. That's formally what they say, because if the president is saying things that are bat spit with a P, insane, the world needs to know that here is the mental state of the president. However, when we see that this is what happens when someone with that much power and that much of a crazed, devoted following has that big of a microphone, we have to recontemplate the effects of these platforms in general.
You know, one last thing on this before we move to the permanent ban. One of the things, Marjorie, I'm going to talk to listeners about later, and we were inspired by a piece that Oliver Darcy wrote on the CNN Reliable Sources Overnight newsletter, is he talked about how there's beginning to be a discussion about how the topic of social media platforms for hate speech or incitement of violence is too narrow a discussion. That it's not just Facebook and Twitter and these other social media platforms, it's cable networks that provide vehicles for the Breitbarts and the One America networks and those sort of things. Is there any discussion about any policing in terms of mis and disinformation in those places, or is this just fantasy talk from some media critics for now?
Not really, because tampering with free speech is a real third rail sort of thing. And furthermore, I don't think it's being discussed enough that the ability of people to say whatever the heck they want on social media, no matter how dangerous, even when it's something that's dangerous as the stuff that we've been seeing, that isn't the real problem. Because remember that 500 million tweets are being posted per day, 500 hours of YouTube videos are being uploaded every minute. It is an impossible task to prevent that stuff from hitting the medium. The real problem is the algorithms. The problems that Twitter and YouTube have created is that the algorithms that are created to expand the audience of this content, they're all working exactly as they were originally intended. They identify content that's rapidly accelerating throughout a specific community, and then it increases the acceleration throughout that community and tries to extend its reach beyond that community. And as I said before, these are things that when you are just a few engineers in a conference room discussing good ideas for how to create a great service, this makes perfect sense. But now that we've seen how dangerous this algorithm can be in spreading this sort of cancer, it's going to be very, very important to increasingly fine-tune those algorithms to make sure that there are roadblocks, that there are speed bumps, that as soon as we identify that something is gaining an unholy amount of traction amongst certain identifiable individuals, it is time to say, guess what, you're now compartmentalized. You don't necessarily violate user content, but we are now compartmentalizing. We're going to cauterize the spread of this particular post so that it's still available, but it's no longer there to influence people that are fairly uninfluenced by this sort of malicious content yet.
Well, you know, it's like the old cliche, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. This is kind of analogous to me in some ways. I mean, you have people writing this week that there would have been no crazed mob at the attacking people and resulting in deaths and destruction, et cetera, without Fox News, without Rush Limbaugh, without these Twitter, obviously, and Facebook, and without these you know, these stop the steal websites that were all over the place.
But you're not suggesting that they can't, if they're not saying and bring your weapons and storm the Capitol, if they simply say the election was stolen, let's gather in Washington to protest, they should be able to do that.
Well, I guess
they?
I'm asking is, you know, we have a First Amendment, we obviously have free speech, but there are certain limits. And I guess that is the question, you know, are our limits up to 2020, when you consider that they were set long before what's happening now was even imagined?
Yeah, in my opinion, it's a choice. Just as we made a choice collectively hundreds of years ago that no, people are in our legal system, people are innocent until proven guilty. We could have gone the other way. We would have had other consequences to that were both bad and good. But that's the choice that we made. I do believe that. It's such a dangerous thing to say that once you step up to a podium and a microphone, we have to control what you say before you say it. Mm-hmm. I think it's more important to simply say that, guess what, Rudy Giuliani, I don't care how great it made you feel to say really, really like bomb throwing things in front of a huge crowd. But now that we see the effect that you had on that crowd, you are now liable to criminal prosecution. Even Trump, I think, should not be considered to be liable for criminal, at least an investigation into whether he is liable for prosecution. This is the thing that I'm personally more comfortable with. You are responsible for the things that you say.
Yeah.
Because I am on a fundamental basis, I'm just a dude right now in front of a microphone, in front of an audience. And I have a responsibility to make sure I'm not saying things that are really, really dumb. And I get to pay the consequences if I say things that are really, really dumb. It would be much more difficult if I'm simply saying, here are the things you are allowed to talk about and not allowed
right.
to talk about beforehand.
Okay.
I don't see a workable solution to that. I know that's a very like freshman college understanding of how the world works. I understand that that can be very naive at times, but that's what I'm comfortable with.
I don't want to belabor this, but I just have one more question about Trump. Other than the inciting people to violence the other day, if Trump were a private citizen and he had tweeted the same things that he has tweeted for 4 years as a private citizen, again, other than what happened in the last couple of days, based on the rules that currently exist, would he have been banned from most social media platforms?
He would have been banned years ago from social media platforms. He is given a special exception here.
Okay.
And this is why what Twitter is doing is actually kind of okay. They're not being arbitrary. They're saying, here are rules that we have laid down. Here are the rules that you have violated. So here is why we are deplatforming you.
Got it. We're talking to Andy Iannacco.
So what's Michelle Obama up to in this regard, Andy Iannacco?
She made a wonderful social media post on Twitter and other places that one of those really wonderful things where you could not, it had to be screenshots of paragraphs of text because she was making an eloquent, full featured statement as opposed to just retweetable quips. And amidst talking about one of the most important things we must discuss when it comes to the effects of events on Wednesday, the disparity between how law enforcement reacted to white people storming Congress versus non-white people who were peacefully protesting Black Lives Matter. She also openly called for the need for social media to be more responsible, and to actually calling for out permanently banning Trump and people who are actively supporting him, which is, again, something that I completely agree with. But when you have it's important that you have voices that are as respected as hers, to not just simply tenderfoot around, oh, well, we must reconsider our policies, we must give thought to what to do. Really, this is so important to simply say that what you actually mean, which is this person has to go from all platforms. He is irresponsible, reckless, and proven to be a dangerous entity. So he has to go as soon as his butt is out the door. I'm sure that he's going to shoot his mouth off and just simply be deplatformed, even if Twitter doesn't simply unilaterally do what Facebook decided to do, which is to just remove him without any further ado.
We're going to talk to listeners about the deplatforming thing, by the way, just to give you a heads up out there a little bit later in the show. You know, many stories have the Georgia victories practically were unreported because of what's gone on the last few days. Something that's totally going to the back burner is the recent Russian hack of obviously government networks, private sector networks. Where are we on that, Andy Anatko?
We are in the hurricane has hit, and now we are just going through all the wreckage, and the list just doesn't simply end. It's hard to underestimate exactly how bad this hack, which has been demonstrated to be of Russian origin, has been. There's a piece of software created by a company called SolarWinds that tens of thousands of corporate and government networks rely on just to keep the network running efficiently. And these hackers managed to insert malware into updates for the software that went out to 18,000 users everywhere. This was undetected by Cyber Command and the National Security Agency. It was only detected by a private company called FireEye on December 13. And so it's hard to know exactly what the damage is. Just today, the Administrative Office of the U.S. Court System, the court system that maintains the electronic case file systems, has announced that there's been an apparent compromise of the confidentiality of that electronic case file systems related to this hack, which means that sealed court documents that have been sealed might have been accessed and offloaded by these hackers. It's part of the, I hate to use my scary voice here, but in addition to the scope of the hack, the other problem is we don't know exactly what these hackers did once they were gaining access. Did they simply insert malicious code into those servers to add backdoors so they can come back later? Were they collecting as much data as they could from these locked up servers? Or one of the worst case scenarios, did they do things like were they targeting, for instance, something like the court system and saying, let's make sure that we download as much of this sensitive sealed case data as we possibly can before our intrusion has been detected and we are shut out. We haven't found the bottom of this yet, and it could be very, very much worse than we even know right now.
We're talking to Andy Anatko, our tech guy.
So, Andy Anatko, as you said in your memo to us, enough depressing news. Tell us about this Mac app and typing. This is a great story.
Well, I mean, those of you who... I'm sorry, I was updating my Facebook while I was talking to you there.
Got it.
Yeah,
very funny.
This is one of the social blights of 2020. We're
exactly.
On chat. Somebody is typing as though they are angry at their keyboard. I'm also because I'm a writer. Like I have this really like loud, noisy, really comfortable to use keyboard. So somebody doing God's work clearly. Doing God's work, I tell you, wrote this application for the Mac called Unclack. You can download it at unclack.app.
Unclack.
And what it does is it monitors your microphone, and whenever it hears the sound of typing, it automatically mutes your microphone so that that does not go out into the chat.
So to be clear, by the way, if you're talking while you're typing, and I know a woman who may be in this discussion right now who does that, The good news is you won't hear the typing. The bad news is you won't hear the speaking either, correct?
We can't be that sophisticated yet, but hopefully it'll teach somebody to maybe switch to like this. What I do is I actually have right now two keyboards hooked up to my computer. One is like a really silent, like notebook style keyboard, so that when I do need to like do a quick web search for something while I'm talking, you don't hear it. So maybe that will like inflict more rules of common positive social conduct upon the people. If you can't like make your feelings known while you're typing, perhaps you should stop typing before you make your feelings known.
I love this thing anyway. It's called Unclack. Is that what it is again? Unclack? Is that what you said?
Unclack. UNCLACK. Unclack.app.
You know, one last thing. What's that?
Jim, I just want to be clear. That's not me. There's somebody,
that,
somebody
that is
else.
So you. It is a drive.
I type
of my mind.
Oh, my God.
Out of my mind.
I think I'm innocent. I'm buying you Unclack
for your birthday. Let me tell you. I'm buying it for you this weekend. Not for your birthday. You know,
okay.
Andy, before you go... I never know if I should care about these kinds of things. Your opinion is that Joe Biden has picked a real good person, whatever that means, to be the White House Director of Technology. Why should I care?
Well, because it means that they're filling really key positions in technology with people who are eminently qualified for the job and have had a lot of experience in that. The White House Director of Information Technology, it should be noted, it's not directly a policy position. It's not with the Office of Science and Technology Policy, for instance. But this person who's been named, David Ricketron, who has, again, just impeccable credentials. He was also the first White House Director of Information Technology when the post was established under Obama in 2015. He's responsible for making sure that the networks and the operations of technology within the White House are secure, and also a little bit within government as well. So his influence, and if he's saying here's how technology should be run within the White House, that has influence both in the private sector and in the government sector. And this is one of the guys who created the system that we use to authenticate people on websites. And he's also built the infrastructure. Now, I'm going to say a nasty word here, but I hope I'm not triggering anybody. When he was earlier in his career, when he was working at Facebook, he helped put together the infrastructure of servers to basically be able to create huge networks at scale. So he's a very, very competent person in this role. And I hope that this reflects that when they do name people for the Office of Science and Technology, which was gutted and ignored. These are the advisors that actually say, when there's a pandemic, here is the science that you need to make your decisions on. When there is like a hack that is affecting hundreds of government servers, here is the science and the technology that is based on what we should do after this. This agency has been pretty much gutted by Trump and ignored in the favor of just people inside the White House inner circle. So this is an area that I'm definitely paying a lot of attention to. And as the Obama transition team keeps naming people that are, again, eminently qualified for this job and have had plenty of experience, that makes me feel very, very good about science and technology for the upcoming 4 years at least.
That's great news. The only correction I'd make, the bad news is not the Obama administration. It's the Biden administration. But hey, if it makes you happy, it makes me happy too, Andy. Let me tell you that.
Sometimes the sequel isn't quite as good as the original, but it's still a good movie.
Andy, it's great to talk to you. Thanks. Happy New Year.
Thanks, folks. Happy New Year to you, too. Merry Christmas for the Orthodox folks as well.
That's right. Andy Inoko joins us regularly. He's a tech writer and blogger. You can find his work at Inoko.com and follow him at Inoko. That is I-H-N as in Nancy, A-T-K-O. Coming up, law enforcement in black and white. Callie Crossy joins us to talk about the role race played in this week's revolt at the Capitol. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as she does every Friday, is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. And that, of course, would be Callie Crossley. Hello there, and Happy New Year, Callie.
Oh, we haven't talked since the New Year?
I don't think so.
Oh, Happy New Year, Jim and Marjorie.
Great to talk to you, as always, Callie Crossley. So let's start with Doc Rivers. What's going on with Doc Rivers?
Well, you know, he has just become somebody who just really, you know, shows his emotions and speaks from the heart. I'm not saying he didn't do it before, but I'm not a sports person, so I know who he is, but I'm not following everything that he says. But,
right.
But after what happened in the Capitol, he made a statement. This was ahead of Wednesday's game against the Washington Wizards. He's a head coach, by the way, of the Philadelphia 76ers.
And he used to be head coach of the Celtics.
Right, exactly, yeah. Which is another reason why I was sort of paid attention to this. And he said, you know, imagine today if those were all black people storming the Capitol and what would have happened. So that to me is a picture that's worth a thousand words for all of us to see and probably something for us to reckon with again. No police dogs turned on people. No billy clubs hitting people. People peacefully being escorted out of the Capitol. So it shows that you can disperse a crowd peacefully. I guess that would be one thing. And then he goes on to talk about how a sad day it is for our country. And for people looking at us from around the world, and you know how hurtful it is to see that there is as we've been talking about, a double standard in how some people are treated. And I thought it was just, you know, it's another heartfelt statement.
Well, you know, it's not only another heartfelt statement. I'm a huge fan of him as a citizen, mm-hmm. not just as a talented basketball coach. But, you know, we've talked to Trina Kuznarek a lot about this, Kelly, but particularly since and before, but particularly since the murder of George Floyd, and as the months have gone forward, a lot of pro athletes have had a profound effect on the national dialogue mm-hmm. around issues of race and justice and those sort of things. And, you know, I'm not one of those, you know, what did Charles Barkley say in that famous commercial, you know, I ain't no role model or
right,
whatever.
Right.
Ordinarily, I think the jocks are not. But particularly young people pay a lot of attention to what the Doc Riverses and the LeBrons of the world have to say. And so I think the contribution of people like Rivers and some of these players is huge in this debate. Do you?
Oh, absolutely. And again, I'm recalling that during that period of George Floyd and others, you know, he made another emotional statement, and I don't think he started off trying to be emotional. He was just trying to comment, and
right.
he broke down.
Yes, I remember.
He just broke
him.
Down and said, "When is this going to stop?" I mean, it was. I mean, you saw his heart, you saw the pain, and he channeled a lot of what many other people were feeling. And again, because of what you said, because he's, you know, with a team, and people follow sports. And perhaps people who might not have heard his message in other arenas would hear it now because he said it. I mean, he's just, it was really powerful.
Really, I agree, mm-hmm. really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on to another figure from this gathering, what am I calling it, gathering for this riot in the Capitol on Wednesday, Ashley Babbitt. Tell us mm-hmm. about her.
So Ashley Babbitt, people are now probably hearing the statistics. At last count, there are five people dead. The last person was a Capitol police officer. But the first person was a woman who was shot as she was trying to break in through the doors of the Capitol. I understand those were the circumstances. I don't know that that's been completely definitively stated. Those were the circumstances, but that's one of the ways I heard it. Anyway, her name was Ashley Babbitt. She was there gathering with all of the people in the mob. It turns out now that she is a QAnon person. You know, we've been talking about that conspiracy theory groups. She thought this was a revolution, and she was a revolutionary now. This all comes from her social media that the FBI and other law enforcement officials have gone back to look at, you know, since her death. So that she wrote on her Facebook, I guess, nothing will stop us. They can try and try, but the storm is here and it is descending upon D.C. in less than 24 hours, dark to light. Well, obviously something stopped her and it's horrible. She was only 35. I mean, this is
Air Force veteran,
yeah.
too. Is she
and
not,
came
I
from
think?
California.
Yeah. yeah. To be
all
a part of
all the way
this.
Across the country.
Yeah. Yeah. There are some in the wake of her death saying, oh, well, we should say her name, which, as you know, is the hashtag attached to Breonna Taylor and other young women who have been killed unarmed. So they're trying to make the point that she was unarmed. I don't know that we know that, because all we've gotten so far is that her name is Ashley Babbitt and she's an Air Force veteran, and some of the other circumstances around her death have yet to be released. So there is that piece of it. But the crowd that she was with, nonetheless, nobody was there nonviolently. They weren't marching in the streets with no arms and suddenly being beaten or attacked. So that is not appropriate, and people are quite angry about it, the attempt to co-opt a phrase, first of all, that's part of the Black Lives Matter movement, and also to attach it to someone who was clearly not about the business. Well, she was about business that was riotous and horrible and seditious, and as the people are saying, it's all of those words.
Well, you know, while a lot of people are saying that it is not appropriate to apply that hashtag, I happen to be with those people who believe it's not appropriate. Somebody who, based on something, we may discuss this briefly earlier on the show, who might believe it was appropriate if he did such things, was Curt Schilling, the huge star of the Red Sox and other teams for a while. He's obviously up for the Hall of Fame again, and Do you either of you have his tweet in front of you? It was in today's
yes.
Boston Globe. Can you share with us, Kelly?
It says, "You cowards sat on your hands, did nothing while while liberal trash looted, rioted, and burned for Air Jordans and big screens. Sit back, shut up, and watch folks start a confrontation for expletive that matters, like rights, democracy, and the end of government corruption."
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to say that's sort of it's almost like he feels bad that he wasn't with them. Is that not your takeaway?
I it's a little stunning. I mean, I know that he's, you know, a conservative guy, and he's often on Twitter, you know, making some statements. This is rather appalling. So apparently he got 70% of the votes cast last year for the Baseball Hall of Fame, and he's up to 72.8 this year. I guess the balloting has happened. I'm not sure the voting has happened, but the balloting has happened. And people are suggesting that maybe this might impact what the final decision may be of those who vote. Are those sports writers? I forgot who votes for this.
I think they are sports writers, and I'm not 100% sure. And I know that there's a big debate in this Hall of Fame voting as to whether or not how one lives one's life off the baseball diamond, how relevant that should be. Because they talk about a lot of, particularly some of the greatest stars, I think Ty Cobb is amongst them,
right,
who have a pretty nauseating history out in the world. A lot of racism among some of the players, overt racism. Some of the players are in the Hall of Fame. And there's a big debate around people like Curt Schilling, who, by the way, this tweet, as offensive as it is, he is not, this is after the fact, he is not urging violence, even though the words I find appalling. It is a free speech kind of thing. It's not like what Donald Trump was doing, at least in my estimation. But I'm guessing, no matter what the rules are, that it, if anything, keeps him out of the Hall of Fame in this vote. And as you mentioned, I think you need 75%. He's very close. My guess is these comments will be what keeps him out.
I have reposted on my Under the Radar Facebook page today a commentary I did in 2017 about freedom of speech and consequences, because people think it's a get out of jail card for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually is not. That came up in my mind this morning, or I thought about it again and reposted it because of Josh Hawley, the senator who lost his book deal and is now claiming, you know, I have freedom of speech and this is horrible. And so if you're taking away my book deal, you know, therefore that's against freedom of speech. No, it's not. But as I wrote in my commentary about a woman who gave the finger to President Donald Trump, she lost her job. Well, she was free to give him the finger, but she doesn't get to keep her job as a result of freedom of speech. I mean, there are consequences.
Yeah.
And so there may be consequences on the Baseball Hall of Fame. There may be consequences for Josh Hawley on his book deal. There's consequences. But that doesn't stop you from having. You are free to say it. But understand that there's no guarantee. The freedom of speech does not guarantee you your job or your award or your honorary degree or whatever else.
You know, Kelly, I'm glad you brought that up. I had forgotten about it. I read this morning when I got up that it's Simon & Schuster, isn't it?
Right.
That pulled the book deal. What's their case that because he was part of
They just want to be associated with it. You know, we're at a time where anybody in business will tell you that it's not only the product, but are the people associated with the product that have an impact on consumers' decisions to purchase. I mean, people are looking to see how do you represent yourself in the world. And if there are a lot of issues that are unsavory, I don't want to be associated with you. Doesn't mean that you can't take your book elsewhere if you chose to. But we, in this case, Simon & Schuster, that this is not something we want to be associated with, not just that it happened and you were a part of it, but that you were egging on people. I mean, remember, this is the guy that they have the photo of him with the raised fist,
right.
You know, outside saying, yeah, guys, come on, do whatever you have to do. This is the guy that even after 8 of his colleagues said, wait, you know, after all of the chaos and the rioting and the rampaging, you know, we're not even going to be a part of this test of this objection to the Electoral College voting, because we know that it's not going anywhere and it's not even worth trying to, you know, push the test. But he was not one. You know, he got up and made a statement saying, well, I abhor the violence, he who with raised fist, but we should be able to, you know, push forward and make this objection, even as he knew this was, you know, had nothing to do with truth.
And the reason, by the way, Marjorie, I think I don't know if you were asking Seth Moulton or you just volunteered it about whether or not, you know, or maybe it was Ayanna Pressley, I'm sorry, do they know what the reality is?
He knows.
Or not? I was just going to say, Josh Hawley is one really smart guy.
He's a very privileged guy. He taught us on Fancy Dancy Prep School. He went to Stanford. He went to Yale Law School. The Yale alumni wrote this letter calling
him. No, he's really smart character.
A disgrace. So, yeah, he absolutely knows. He does this because he thinks he's going to ride the Trump train to run for president. In a couple of years. He also lied about Antifa coming to his house and banging on his door.
Right.
I'm not a fan of people going to protests in people's houses and painting people's houses, whether it's Nancy Pelosi or Mitch McConnell. But he lied about that. The video showed that wasn't what happened.
Right.
People came to his house. There wasn't this endless bang on the door, and it wasn't Antifa. Boy, Antifa really is everywhere these days.
Yeah.
They seem to be.
Well, they would like, you know, like
every
it
time
to
we
be.
Turn around, it's another, oh, no, it's Antifa.
You know?
Oh, God.
You know, Callie, we can end with, since we started with sports, since you're such a huge sports fan, we can end with sports. LeBron James, who I think his performance has been, I'm not talking about on the court.
Right.
I mean, it is just, he is an engaged
and the WNBA
citizen. What's that?
In general. The NBA and the WNBA in general.
They've been great.
Great. Great.
So, Kelly Loeffler, I assume people know, I think it's called the Atlanta Dream,
mm-hmm.
owns
mm-hmm.
a WNBA team. We talked about it yesterday, that the members of the team not only wanted her, were criticized her when she criticized Black Lives Matter protests during the summer, but they also went to the commissioner and were urging the commissioner to throw her out of the league, which the commissioner apparently didn't have the power to. LeBron's got another way around it, does he not?
Yes, he's asking for people to join him in putting together an ownership group for the Atlanta Dream to buy her out. I mean, he's got plenty of money. Now, let's be clear. Her husband became a billionaire during the time of her running in Atlanta. He was a pretty rich guy anyway, but he apparently, you know, got even more money during this period of time. So she's not hurting for any funds as well, but no one understands why she wants to own this team. She also sponsored a bill that targets transgender athletes.
Yeah.
So it's like, really? What are you doing with this? So anyway, he's asking for people to join him. Apparently Mookie Betts said, yeah, count me in. So
yeah.
That's maybe something will happen with it. I mean, I like people who are coming up with some constructive ways of channeling, you know, rage.
That's right.
You know, I think that's he's very impressive in that way. He says he's going to do something. He does it. He's committed to it. I mean, I keep thinking about the school that he created, you know, all those backpacks he's given to kids, those poor kids who didn't have anything. I mean,
he's walking the walk.
He really is. He really is.
You know, one of the things about the Loeffler thing that I find interesting, and you'd mentioned Hawley and Simon & Schuster canceling the book deal. What kind of accountability? Again, this is not somebody who has a different position. If somebody supports Donald Trump and likes his brand of politics, listen, so be it.
You're entitled to do that. Right.
But when somebody supports the subversion of democracy and the overturning of an election based on nothing,
right,
I think there should be some price to pay. I'm really anxious to see 2 or 3 years down the line what happens to those 147 members of the House who voted to, along with the challenges to the certification, I guess, of Arizona, to the 6 senators, including Hawley and Ted Cruz, who thought it was their ticket to the presidency in 4 years. It's going to be really interesting. And Kelly Loeffler, who bought into the overturning of the election. I don't think she ultimately voted.
No, she's
for it.
She stepped away.
She did step away.
She changed her mind.
Right. But her whole race was her whole campaign was gluing herself to the election challenge and that sort of thing. It'd be interesting to see whether there is a price exacted by the American people, or if it turns out that we are more forgiving than we sometimes tend to be.
Listening to Ted Cruz try to come up with some reason why it was all okay what he did, I mean, if anybody would vote for him at this point, I have no words. This man is supporting the guy that talked about his wife. For God's sake, have some dignity about yourself. I mean, this is just, ugh.
By the way, for those who don't know, we've mentioned a few times, when he says the guy, Donald Trump not only suggested that that Ted Cruz's wife was ugly in a tweet where he had a photograph of Melania Trump and Cruz's wife, but also suggested that Ted Cruz's father was part of a conspiracy to assassinated JFK.
JFK, that's right.
Despite that fact, that, and by the way, if you Google some of what Cruz said during that presidential campaign about Donald Trump, and then you look at the loyalty of Ted Cruz, God. It is other.
Don't
it's sort of like
wonder,
Lindsey Graham.
Don't you
that's
wonder
terrible.
What's going on there? I mean, what does his wife think about this? What do his
this
children
is what
think
I
about
know.
This? I want an extensive interview with the wife and the children of Ted Cruz.
Why don't you do that?
I should do that, Jim.
I would like to know, because I just find it. They were having dinner together. Yeah. They were doing couples night, he and Melania and Ted.
Were.
And I mean, are you kidding? I just...
I don't want to know about that, frankly. Okay.
Okay.
So what are you doing a Sunday night, Kelly Crossley?
We're doing a full hour with the Mass Politics Profs to put some historical and political context around the not only the events in the Capitol, but looking at the historic Senate victories, looking at the climate change legislation locally. And we had a robust discussion about Marty Walsh and whether he should have been the face or should be the face of New Labor, which some people firmly believed and others didn't, because, you know, labor has changed as from the time that Biden the guy in that arena. So it's really interesting in general, just all the stuff that's going on and trying to sort through it with the help of very learned folks.
You know, I'm really glad you're talking about the Georgia thing. Ayanna Pressley, when we were talking to her at the top of the show today, when we were talking about the horrors of Wednesday, went out of her way, and I'm glad she did, to say, I want to talk about the joy. I don't know if she used the word joy, but it was close to that, of what happened in Georgia. And, you know, the history that was made, the impact that, again, even if you weren't for Warnock and Ossoff, I hope people can appreciate how the world has changed. And I'm glad you're doing it, because we haven't done it enough. We've been so buried in all of the horrors of this week.
Yeah.
And so we'll be listening.
I'm hopeful that, you know, often what happens is you're just so opposed, you're so opposed, you're so opposed, and the people get the job and they start doing it. And you actually can open up to seeing what they're doing, because, you know, nobody's perfect. But I do believe that they're in the business of really trying to help the people. And I think that's more, as Ossoff said himself, that's more than the people that voted for him.
Yeah. Callie, we'll be listening. Good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Callie, thanks again. Callie Crossley is the host of Under the Radar, with Callie Crossley, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. You can subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes. Follow her on Twitter at Callie Crossley. Up next, we're opening the lines and asking you what to do about media online, on TV, on radio, not us, of course, Jim, who knowingly, with malice of forethought, spout lies and half-truths and no truths at all that half of America seems to believe. Our number is 877-381-8970, 877-381-8970, or BPR at WGBH.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And we started this discussion with Andy Anatko, our tech guy, a couple of minutes ago. Let me tell you what the factual assumption that we are making to begin this conversation. Andy Anatko said unequivocally that if it were not for the public leader or public interest exception that allows people like Donald Trump, elected leaders on social media, to cross lines that private citizens could not, he would have been banned. And I asked him a question near the end. I said, if Donald Trump had said the same things on social media that he has said, even without the incitement to violence the other day, all the other stuff, and was a private citizen, would he be banned from these social media platforms? And Andy, without even taking a breath, said yes. So we want to talk to you in the remaining minutes about whether or not, assuming he continues his ways, Donald Trump should be banned come January 21st from social media. And we want to take it a step further. As Marjorie was mentioning a couple of minutes ago, this piece on Reliable Sources, which is the overnight newsletter on the media from CNN, usually Brian Stelter, but last night was Oliver Darcy, saying, why do we demand, some of us demand, of social media platforms responsibility in terms of what people like Donald Trump say, but don't demand the same level of responsibility from cable networks that put on Donald Trump, allowing him to say the same things that he couldn't say in the future on social media, for OAN, One America Network, Breitbart News, whatever it is, to basically spew lies and disinformation. And we want to know, because there are a lot of free speechers out there that get great concern about this, about whether or not you would like to see them all step up to the plate and say to the Trumps of the world, Donald Trump, private citizen in particular, ex-president in particular, this is no more place for you. And I want to read one line, Marjorie, before we get your thoughts. Is it was a great Politico story in their magazine I read in the middle of the night last night. And the guy, I can't remember who wrote it, made a point that I guess is obvious after I read it, but I hadn't thought about it. Without access to these traditional social media channels, his, meaning Donald Trump's, almost 89 million Twitter followers, his going on 33 million Facebook fans, his Instagram, his YouTube, and his Twitch, can Trump continue to pack the same level of cultural and political sway without Twitter? In other words, what is Trump? And the answer is, I think an ex-president without Twitter and the others is not much. And if he chooses to cross the lines and they choose to shut him down, is that something people are comfortable with? The number is 877-301-8970. You're a free speech person. Are you comfortable with it?
With his Twitter account being shut down, you mean?
And not getting access to say the same thing on a cable network that he would be precluded from saying on Twitter. Are you okay with that?
What I have in general is a big problem with any lies that are in the media that are not corrected. That's what I have a big problem with. And I guess Twitter...
What's a lie, by the way?
Well, sometimes it's basically fact. I mean, as I said before, I've been a newspaper reporter all my life. If you write something that's wrong, you have to fix it. And if you don't get fix it, you often get sued. That's why Sidney Powell is being sued by Dominion, because she was claiming over and over again that they screwed up the voting machines. And they're also suing Newsmax, and they're also suing Fox News. You get sued for making those mistakes. What we have now, and there was a great example in about the Washington Times, which is the other newspaper, conservative newspaper in Washington, that did what we talked about with our listeners yesterday, that they were blaming this riot at the Capitol on Antifa. And they published a story about that, and they claimed that this retired military officer reported facial recognition firm XR Vision doing facial recognition of protesters, and they matched to Antifa members and blah, blah, blah. The story was false, but the story was repeated over and over again by a guy that was recently hired by Trump's Department of Justice. It was on all over Facebook. This Tito Ortiz guy, who's a conservative personality, he tweeted this. The Blaze had this. It goes around the media. And I'm not as smart enough to know what to do about this, but I know this is a big problem, because when you look, we just talked with Callie Crossley about the woman who was tragically killed in the was shot at the Capitol. She believed this. You listen to the people that were there being interviewed that were rioting in the Capitol. They believe this. So you have a big problem. We talked about it earlier today about the Philippines. I mean, we're not the Philippines, but when this kind of these kinds of lies are spread, and by the way, we in the mainstream media were very slow to call them lies coming from the Trump administration. We are very slow to call them lies. We're slow to call them racist as well. That it's a big problem. And I don't know what to do about it. I just know that we've got to do something about it.
Well, I am nowhere near you are. I should interrupt you. Nowhere near you are. If it turns out that a lot of people want to talk on television networks, on social media about how there's a deep state, and I don't believe it's factually true, my attitude is go for it. My position, I'm talking about the kind of things that Donald Trump does that incite violence. Not if people misinformation, what are you going to have? Some arbiter who's going to decide whether something is factually accurate?
As I told you, I've been a newspaper reporter all my life.
Your boss required you to do it.
That means you're a journalist.
Whose boss is going to require it in a public sphere?
I guess what I'm saying is that journalism used to be about telling the truth. Now it is about saying anything you want and getting away with it. Maybe you don't think that's a problem. I think that's a problem.
No, I think the answer is you counter it with facts. I'm not talking at all. You're talking about balance. I am talking about when people like Donald Trump cross a line, and I don't just mean doing false information, like incitement to violence when he's a private citizen. I am totally fine with him not only being shut down on social media, but being shut out of cable networks. They should have the same responsibility that Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey do. But in any case, rather than you and me arguing, why don't we take some calls? 877-301-8970. I guess the question is, pulling from what Marjorie and I are both saying, how closely should speech be policed on all of these platforms? And I totally agree with this writer from Politico. Without Twitter, there is no Donald Trump. And so should he have no Twitter? Let's start with Kevin in Brookline. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Kevin.
Well, as always, you folks stir it up. And
oh, hey, Kevin.
For you.
Good to talk to you.
Hello. Happy New Year. Happy New Year.
And to you.
To you, too.
I've tried not to call for a bit because among my folks, I'm starting to get known for talking to you folks, which I enjoy a lot. But this is quite
that's not a crime, by the way.
Movie.
I want you to know that's we consider that a good thing. But go right ahead, Kevin.
I do as well. Well, I think it's interesting because it's twofold. Throughout history, masses of people believe what they want to believe and can justify anything, be it slavery, the Holocaust, internment camps for folks. So if they get news stories that help them and make their belief system more palatable, they're all for it. And so, you know, it's like, okay, so great. Yes, I agree. And, you know, it was a rigged election and so on and so forth, no matter what the facts are. But the problem is that when you've got so many different news outlets that sway in either direction, there's no more, right? There's no more Walter Cronkite.
So what do you do about it, Kevin? We all agree is a problem. What do you do about it?
I think what you have to do about it is you've got to find someone who truly, truly is above it all. And that's a tough one, but they're out there, right? You know, you've got to find someone so respected, and you look at their record, and people say, well, I'm going to go to him, and also who understands that every issue is complicated, right? There is no black and white. There's no everybody who feels this way. There's no stereotypes. It's like, it's a super complicated problem. I mean, the two of you are about as like-minded as they come, but you still take opposite ends to so many different issues and both get heated because you're passionate people.
So, but Kevin, let me put words in your mouth. You seem to be saying we shouldn't shut anybody down. What we should do is find credible sources of information that we can go to when we are in doubt that will help us determine where the truth lies. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think, yeah, and I think it needs to be as if, you know, the same rules apply to you on the street. You know, like the old tape of showing the guy that picked, you know, he picks the heavily Jewish populated neighborhood to go and celebrate Hitler's birthday. We had to watch that film when we were kids and discuss freedom of speech. I can go into a movie theater, but I can't yell fire. Right? It's like, you know, and so it becomes the same thing. I can say what I want online until, and here's why I agree with you, until I incite people to violence.
Right. And that's why Trump was shut down from the other day, and temporarily at least. And if he does the same, I assume he'll be banned, and I think he should be. By the way, Kevin, when we say we recognize and we met Kevin, we should just say one of our favorite organizations, Banned in Boston, the wonderful event that we've done every year for the last few years, and it supports the wonderful Urban Improv, which is where Kevin was in his former life. Check it out. It's a great group. Kevin, thank you so much for your thoughts, as always. 877-301-8970. You think the Fairness Doctrine is really the solution, don't you? I mean, that is
the restoration. I don't know what the solution is. You know, I've been criticized on that opinion a million times because people say it's too late for that because of the internet. As I said before, I'm not smart enough. I just don't, you know, to drag out the old Daniel Patrick Moynihan line, you're entitled to your own opinion, not entitled to your own facts. And I think that the fact that people knowingly, and they know it, lie night after night after night on Fox News, they're continuing to lie about this election was stolen, and you know, this was terrible, and you know, there were, you know, votes in suitcases and blah blah blah. When people in those positions continue to lie, it has a very corrosive effect. I think it's already had a very corrosive effect.
I couldn't agree more.
I don't know what to do about it. I just know it should not. To me, that's not a making up facts on the airwaves is not a free speech issue. Making up lies is different, I think. Well, when you know, especially.
There. Faith, you're okay. North Andover. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I love you guys.
Thanks.
I guess I agree more with Marjorie because I'm thinking that these cable networks, the OAN,
Newsmax.
I think they should be held to the Newsmax. Thank you so much. I think they should be held to the same standard as NBC, CBS. I mean, you can't be just stating lies and not having any consequences for it.
But Faith, if I can interrupt you, it's sort of like Marjorie's when she was talking about when she was a newspaper reporter and columnist. NBC, since you picked it, self-polices. It isn't like there's some outside force that says to NBC, you have to be responsible. They choose to be responsible. If OAN chooses to be as grossly irresponsible as they are, who steps in and does something? I mean, what happens then? Or Newsmax, as you say. Who polices them? Or should anybody police them?
Laws and rules and regulations, whoever. You guys would know better than I do, but somebody has to tell NBC. You can't just be swearing. You can't be...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You can't be... you know what I'm saying? I mean, I think that they should have some kind of rules and regulations as much as the bigger name. Because they spew these things. And then I look at Facebook, and people pick up on that, and it snowballs into craziness. Like,
well, that's why 70% of Republicans in this country believe the election was stolen, essentially.
I know. It's just
Faith, thank you.
Faith,
we appreciate
you
your call.
Very much
thank you
for the call. You know what's a great example is what right-wing media has done about coronavirus. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have 300, how many thousand people are dead now?
60,000 maybe, I think.
You know, lying about how serious this was, lying about masks, all these things. I mean, they, again, if these were just people that were bonkers and didn't know the difference, but they do know the difference. And to be able to say that night after night after night.
But see, I think that is like screaming fire in a crowded theater. I don't think going on television, I don't like it, and saying or on social media that the election was stolen is in the same category. I think if you say the election is stolen, and by the way, let's go wild at the United States Capitol in response to that, that is crossing a line. And I think saying
Is it crossing
COVID-
a line? Is it crossing a line to Photoshop and put stuff up on YouTube that it totally distorts what exactly happened? Or
like
to,
deep fakes, you mean, that sort of stuff, those videos. Yeah,
I think is that okay?
I think it's not okay. See, the problem the problem with all this stuff is who sets the standard is the bottom line. And would you not agree? I mean, there is no national standard setting, nor do you want there to be, do you?
Well, I think in the libel law, to knowingly print something that's false, a false fact, you get a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. Part of the problem with this, of course, the internet is new and we haven't really thought it through. But that's been kind of a standard for a long time.
Yeah, but there can't be 10 million lawsuits filed every single day, Marjorie. Litigation is not going to solve the problem.
I don't have a solution to this, especially involving the internet. But I know there have been standards that have worked reasonably well, not without errors and not without problems.
Well, can I go back to where I started? Because I think this conversation, my view is, just as we discussed with Andy, the rules that caused Donald Trump's Facebook and Instagram and others to be taken away by Mark mm-hmm. Zuckerberg till the 21st, taken away by Twitter for 24 hours, are the same kinds of rules that should apply to television networks. It wasn't just because he said something that was factually inaccurate. It went beyond that. And I have no problem shutting that stuff down because, again, if you're inciting somebody to commit violence, you are yelling fire in a crowded theater. And I think you should be shut down in all forms, which basically means we'd almost never hear from Donald Trump again. Let's go to Sam in the car. Hi.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the difference between maybe what social media platforms are morally obligated to do versus should we legally regulate like repealing Section 230 and having them have liability.
Mm-hmm. Which is what Donald Trump wanted in the defense bill. Yeah.
Right. So I think morally it's clear that these platforms aren't to do something like ban Donald Trump, ban people they are aware, are spreading misinformation and inciting violence. I think the issue comes in where what you've been talking about, where when you want to put in these legal regulations, I think you might worry that, when your people aren't, if there's someone in power who you're worried is going to, use like, regulate social media platforms to further their goals, you might worry about that. So I think we ought to call on these platforms to morally do something about it. But I think pursuing legal regulations, I think we should think more before we take that route.
Sam, can I give you an example? I should have thought this ages ago. The first time Marjorie and I started having this discussion is when you almost went out of your mind when the death with dignity ballot question was on the ballot here. Was it the ads paid for by the Catholic Church?
Yes.
They put you over the edge because they
absolutely
were so full lies. And the question, and unfortunately we're pretty much out of time, Sam, thanks for the call, is, again, do you want television advertising to be policed and if the answer is you do, by whom? I mean, who do you trust?
Well, I'll end this with Alpha Darcy's statement from this newsletter.
Yeah.
From reliable sources. It's time for TV carriers to face questions for lending their platforms to dishonest companies that profit off disinformation and conspiracy theories. And I think you can apply that to TV and radio and other media that knowingly lie to their viewers to make money.
We're not going to solve this today, Jim.
Anyway, we are done. Thank you very much for tuning in to Boston Public Radio. Thank you for listening in this incredible week. Monday, we're going to be joined by financial columnist Michelle Singletary.
Oh, that's great.
Who is absolutely fantastic. You're going to love her. She's great about money. She's great about a lot of other stuff. And Senator Ed Markey is going to talk about what's transpiring this week and what's going to happen, if anything, with the 25th Amendment and Trump getting out of office through impeachment. Our crew, we'd like to thank Chelsea Murray, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubley, Aidan Conley, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, Miles Smith, and Dave Goldstein run our remote studios. You're not on TV tonight, Jim, but Emily Rooney is. So you can tune into her at 7 o'clock on GBH. We've also got that wonderful Frontline documentary about Duterte, which...
Thousand Cuts, it's great. Well, it's not just about Duterte, it's about a brilliant, courageous... fearless, funny, full life journalist.
Yes.
I mean,
she's
amazing.
And her crusade against lies going unchecked.
That's a very good point. And you know how she's checking them, by the way? She's checking them with fabulous journalism. She's not shutting them down, right?
Not yet.
No, I don't think she
I'm
wants
Marjorie
to.
Egan.
I don't think she
I'm
wants
Marjorie
to.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
Yeah, and I'm Jim Browdy. Have a wonderful weekend and stay
Thanks
safe.
Thanks for tuning
and we'll
in.
Talk
Bye.
To you on Monday.